To order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. We're going to take bills up as people who are in the room. Senator Anderson's not here. Senator Larson, are you present? Senator Bickerman, are you present? Senator Lurie, we're ready for Senate File 3098, Lawful Gambling Provisions Modifications, and Senate File 3171.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do have an author's amendment to, we are going to combine these two bills into one, following suit with what the House did, actually. This is a Allied Charities bill and a Gambling Control Board bill, and we're putting them together on Senate File 3098, which is the Allied Charities version. I believe you have the delete all amendment in front of you.
Do you want the vehicle to be 3098,
yes.
Senator Lurie? Okay, we will. We are going to be putting aside Senate File 3171 and taking up only Senate File 3098. And we have a delete all amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct. It is the A8 amendment. You should have that in your packet, I believe.
This is an author's amendment. Senator Marty moves adoption of the A8 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the delete all amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said, this is charitable gambling bill. The proposed changes affect the regulators and the charitable organizations themselves, and they both agree to these provisions. And they are also supported by the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, I should add. The bill essentially has some technical changes to clarify regulations. It has a revised civil penalty provision, again, supported by the industry, and a temporary allowance, a little bit of relief from the current expense limits relative to the impact on charitable gambling from both the economic downturn and the smoking ban. I'll step you through the bill quickly. Sections 1 and 2 clarify a promotional ticket, what a promotional ticket is, and manufacturing standards. Section 3 allows a temporary increase of 5% in expense limits for 1 year only, due to the fiscal impact from both the economic downturn and the recent smoking ban. Charities have seen a drop in sales, and of course, I think we're all familiar with the fact.
Senator Lurie, excuse me. Also, we don't have the delete all amendment.
Oh,
Chair, I don't either. So,
Senator Lurie, do you know where it is?
I have one.
That's who counts.
I have four, I guess. Apologies for that. Would you like me to take up another bill while copies are made, or should I? I've got some other simple bills before the committee. Or
yes.
Okay.
We're Let's going to lay aside Senate File 3098 until we have the amendments copied. But we will go ahead and let you do those other two. I know you have other responsibilities here, and think these are pretty straightforward.
Let's, if we could, do 3364.
3364 is before. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill for the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing in Minnesota. It is a name change. The reason for the name change is that families and individuals who are deaf blind have asked that we include their name in the title. The legislature added individuals who are deaf blind to the group of individuals that this commission serves back in 1996, but the name was never changed to reflect that.
Senator, you have a delete all for this bill, too?
Yes, I do have a delete all for this as well. It is
Senator Lurie moves adoption of the delete all amendment, AO8-1223, to Senate File 3364. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 3364 as amended. before us. Is that the only change that's made?
Well, there's two other very small changes. I'll just go through them quickly. There's people first language in there. People with disabilities really prefer to be described as people first and then their disabilities as a characteristic. So people with people who are hard of hearing and deafblind rather than deafblind people. There's a change in the language to include all three branches of government because this commission does interact with all three branches of government, and it also allows them to meet via electronic means.
Which is just boilerplate language.
It's just boilerplate language.
And other groups.
It is a non-controversial set of technical changes to allow the commission to work better together, and it has no known opposition whatsoever. I have Mary Hartnett available if anyone has any questions, but if not, I would recommend that Senate File 3364 be recommended to pass.
Are there any questions for Senator Loring or for the potential witness on this bill? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in favor or opposed to the bill?
Consent calendar.
Senator Lori, Senator Marty is wondering whether you would whether you would like to have the bill go to the consent calendar.
That would be a very nice thing.
Is there any objection from the members for the motion to read to go to the consent calendar? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 3364, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. As many are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Do we have the, yeah, I know, do we have the 3098 before us?
Do we have the amendment?
Now? Still being copied. Senator Lori, let's go back to the top of the agenda, if you don't mind. We're going to take Senator Anderson's bill now. Senator Anderson brings us Senate File 2818.
Madam Chair, did you? It's Senate File 3076, I believe. I'm sorry, I've got the wrong bill. I'm trying to catch up here. Okay. Right. Of course. The chair is always right. Senate File 2818. Madam Chair, this is the cap and trade bill, and there's several sections to it, but I think the only one that your committee is, as far as I understand, is concerned about relates to a team of legislators that we'd like to appoint to help participate in and help to advise the governor's process of negotiating a Midwest regional cap and trade agreement. And we do have an amendment prepared by your council, A11.
Madam Chair, I have misplaced that amendment. I need to go retrieve it.
Oh. Sorry, then, Senator Anderson, we're,
do you want to wait?
We'll have to lay it over.
That's fine. Okay. I'll be here.
We'll be back. We'll be back as soon as we get it. You know, things happen really fast here when you get 17 bills on the agenda. Senator Larson, Senate File 1297.
I hope Larson has his documents.
Yeah. Senator, who's on the election? Senator Gerlach moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 1297. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We now have Senate File 1297 as amended in the subcommittee before us. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we also have a technical amendment, the A4 amendment. I don't know if that's in
the
numbers.
A4 amendment.
Move the A4
should be
amendment.
In people's packets. Since this is not
that one's there.
The first time we've heard the bill, would you just explain what the technical amendment does?
Sure. And actually, I'm going to have Ms. Frazier from the – it's the first time I've seen it as well. It's a technical amendment that's been worked out with counsel. Ms. Fraser, why don't you explain
Ms. Fraser, if you'll identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Beth Fraser. I'm with the Office of the Secretary of State. The this bill basically allows the Secretary of State to get...
We just need the amendment. Explanation.
Okay.
Of the technical amendment A4.
The technical amendment clarifies that the Secretary of State will get monthly updates of individuals who are registered to vote, will get monthly updates of those who have filed permanent forwarding orders, not monthly updates of every Minnesotan who has filed a permanent forwarding order.
And then the line 18, deleting everything after the if, and then before the second the... Is that?
That deletes text that's redundant since we're changing the previous sentence.
Okay. Everybody understand that this is a technical amendment? Senator Larson moves adoption of the A4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson, what does this bill do?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1297. Are the provisions that remain from last year's bill regarding automatic voter registration as it related to driver's licenses? We had a great deal of discussion last year regarding that bill. Given the controversy of it over the interim, the Secretary of State's office with the governor's office, many other parties got together and came up with provisions that were agreeable to all as it relates to this topic, because the bill had previously done many things. What this bill now does, as amended, would provide for an address update system of our voter file, so that when someone in Section 1 provides that when non-forwardable mailing or when an address is changed, the Secretary of State has the ability to update the voter's residence. And if that change occurs within Minnesota, that update can occur automatically. If, in fact, there is a move by a forwarding move by the person out of state, there is a process by which the voter is notified that it's been known that they have moved, and it verifies that they will, in fact, no longer be registered to vote unless they contact Secretary of State's office to clarify the matter. This is, frankly, a process that other states have employed to have better, more accurate lists with the Secretary of State's office. And, again, these are all provisions that have been agreed to by the governor's office and the Secretary of State's office as positive ways to move our list forward in Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, I would answer any questions if anyone has more detailed questions. We covered this very thoroughly in the subcommittee. I'd be happy to answer.
Are there questions for Senator Larson about Senate File 1297 as amended? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1297? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1297 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Larson, you want to go ahead and take... Senator Larson, is your next bill one without controversy?
It is. I don't know if it's without controversy. I think that I know the League of Cities will want to comment on the bill. I'm not sure if they're going to oppose it or not. Do you want us to take it now, or do you want me to wait?
I think we will revert again to the top of the agenda. We do have Senator Anderson's bill.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
We are trying to take the bills of people who are not members of the committee. Most of the other bills are ours. Senator Anderson, Senate File 2818, we now have your amendment.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. This relates to the cap and this is the cap and trade bill, Senate File 2818. Thank you. And the amendment, and as I understand it, the jurisdiction of this committee relates only to the narrow issue of legislators being appointed to participate in or to have a voice in the governor's greenhouse gas agreement negotiation plan. The governor has signed an agreement with six other Midwestern states and the province of Manitoba to move forward with a regional Midwest cap and trade system. And legislatures have no official part in that process. And we have been talking about setting up a system whereby some Minnesota legislators could be appointed to attend those meetings if possible in the Midwest and be advised about the progress of the negotiations and give advice to the stakeholders that are negotiating on behalf of the governor and give advice to the governor's staff. I don't believe there's opposition from anybody to this part of my bill. And I think there's pretty broad support for the concept of having legislative participation set up in a role like this. We're not expecting that legislators would have a vote in the negotiations or have any kind of a formal part in the governor's decision-making process. Rather, it's just a way for the legislature to stay apprised of what's happening because we'll be involved in future implementation decisions.
Senator Anderson, we do have the A11 amendment before us. Senator Lurie moves the A11 amendment, and I'm going to suggest a couple of changes to it. Senator Anderson, even though I know you are a big sports fan, we usually don't
team.
we usually don't call those legislators who act in an advisory capacity to any other entity a team. So I'm going to suggest that Senator Lurie amend the A11 amendment by striking a team on lines 1.5, 1.13, and 1.17 and insert the word group in those three places. And then, Senator Anderson, there's a blank in terms of the appointing authorities completing their appointments. Would you like to make a suggestion to fill in the blank? We need to do that here.
Madam Chair, I haven't really thought about it. I think probably April or May would be appropriate, as soon as possible.
Do you anticipate this bill passing?
Yeah, I suppose
by April?
No. I suppose May, by the end of May, probably would be
about,
appropriate.
About June 1st.
Sounds good.
Moves to he's moving this bill, this amendment, and he is incorporating those changes of changing team to group and inserting June 1st on line 117.
Madam Chair, those are very good suggestions.
Is there any discussion? And what this amendment does then is Mr. Bodern is to bring the advisory group into conformity with the guidelines established by this committee on advisory groups. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members, that is correct. It is somewhat different from many of the other advisory groups the committee has considered. The only thing I'd point out, there really isn't any kind of opportunity for anybody to serve as a chair or anything like that. You may wish to consider designating a lead member of the group, but I think it works without that.
But they are the advisory group that is being established is an advisory group to the a council or a group that's already in existence. So
Madam Chair, I don't anticipate that these advisory legislators would have, you know, they don't have separate meetings or anything like that. They're just trying to follow the process that's going on already. And so I don't know that we need that sort of formality
any more
or structure.
Formality here. I think I would agree with that. If this was a totally separate group, but it's not supposed to be that, we would ask for that. Senator Day.
Madam Chair, And we do this all the time, and I personally don't like it, but I'll explain what it is.
Mm-hmm.
In the Senate, we always say two members of the minority party and one member of the majority party and one member of the minority party. I totally agree with that because that's the makeup of our deal. Mm-hmm. But then it always says in the Senate, appointed by the Senate subcommittee and committees of the rules. In the House, they do it totally different. They say two members, majority party, one member of the minority party, but then the Speaker of the House and the minority leader get to pick the person. And after 9 years running a caucus, it's much better and much, I think, a much fairer way is to let the minority leader pick his person and let the majority leader pick their two people. What happens is what you do is you have the majority party then actually picking all three, because what they will do is sometimes pick somebody that is favorable to their position. And when you have a group of, 20 or 30 individuals and you're the leader of them, that's just normal. So I know we do this quite a bit, and
Senator Day, I actually agree with you, but I think that maybe it's an issue for it in that regard, since the bill will eventually end up in the Rules Committee for them to make that determination. But what I think we've tried to do is when a group is being established that is long-term, that we have suggested that the subcommittee on subcommittees or whatever it is, subcommittee on committees make those appointments, because that's a tradition in the Senate. But when it is short-term or immediate, either it needs to be done quickly or it is more or less of an ad hoc group that's not going to be around for a long time, that they follow the suggestion that you just made. And I certainly would be open in this instance, since the appointments are requested by June 1st, according to the author's wishes, that we could go ahead and make that change here, and then the Committee on Rules could change it back if they want to do that. Would you like to make that amendment?
Madam Chair, I would like to make that motion.
So Senator Day moves that on line 1.7, after the word Senate, insert appointed by the majority leader. And then on line 1.8, after the word party, insert appointed by the minority leader. And insert after party, insert appointed by the minority leader, delete the rest of the line, and delete line 1.9 until the second and. To accomplish what he wants to do.
Keep the semicolon.
And keep the semicolon. Discussion?
Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
I agree with that as well, and I think it is appropriate for the minority party to choose their own representatives. And I think I would have assumed that's what the subcommittee on committees would take that into advisement, but this is a more transparent and direct way of doing that. So I certainly support the amendment.
Well, again, when we do it, when we have, commissions or groups that are going to be in existence for a long time or a lot of time for the appointment process, we have abided by the tradition in the Senate, mm-hmm. but we've done it both ways. So we have Senator Day's amendment. Is there further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. To the amendment. Now we have Senator Lori's motion to adopt the A-11 amendment as amended before us. Any further discussion? Or did we already adopt that? Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We did have one person who wanted to testify, Ms. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, we're on the bill now, right?
Yes, that's correct.
I would like to
ask a question, too.
When it's appropriate.
Okay. All right, Ms. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Schmidt. I represent Flint Hills Resources, and I know today is not the day for me to go through my testimony, so I've prepared it, and I can give it to the committee. I just wanted to address the narrow focus of this particular committee, and while we agree that legislative input is very important in this process, we agree that this is a good addition to the legislation. The one thing I would say, however, is in Section 2, the principles section, it is very prescriptive as to the type of discussion that's going to go on. And I think really what is unfortunate is that we'll tie the hands of not only the governor but also the legislative panel members that are appointed to this group. We think the legislation would be better if it allows for the studies to take place within the legislation with the input of the legislature, and then after that information is actually obtained, to come back and then set the principles and the direction of the legislature. So that, I think, is what's important for this committee to consider, whether or not Subdivision 2 is appropriate in light of the fact that it will be prescribing a cap-and-trade program as the program to look at. It'll also be talking, I think it's been changed a bit, but talking principally in the testimony about auction. All of the testimony from a lot of the proponents have identified that there will be significant costs associated with these changes in a cap-and-trade. And for the purview of this committee, I think it's important to consider that those costs will also translate into costs for state agencies as well as local governments as well. So with that, I will just end my testimony. You can read my full remarks and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Are there questions for Ms. Schmidt? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I'm interested in Senator Anderson's response to that because I kind of agree with that. This is kind of analogous to legislative findings, except we're directing a study to be done, and we kind of set forth
the conclusion,
the answer here. So what does Section 2 accomplish? We would like to have the study be done. It does indicate certain things that must be studied as part of it. That's fine. But if we set forth the result, why do we need to have the study be done at all?
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Betzel. This bill actually did have findings in it originally, and I've deleted those. And these are intended for a slightly different purpose. The governor, first of all, it's just to be clear that the governor has signed an agreement with six other states to embark on a regional cap-and-trade program. So the process of creating a model rule for that cap-and-trade program has begun. The first meeting is this week. And that will move forward. A model rule under their agreement is to be written by this November 2008. And so the decision about a cap and trade has been made by at the governor level, and the negotiations and discussion are already underway and will be going on between now and November before the next legislative session. That is why we would like to establish some principles which would simply give guidance. They are not mandatory or binding on the governor or on the legislature, for that matter, but to give guidance in those regional negotiations. The studies that are in place are the result of a great deal of conversation about a lot of very good questions about what the economic and environmental costs and benefits of a regional cap-and-trade system would be and how it should be structured. I agree that it would be nice to have the results of all those studies. However, we don't have that option in front of us before the governors begin negotiating. They're already starting their negotiations, and so the point of this bill is to say as long as that train has left the station and is moving forward at the governor's level, then the legislature also needs to be part of that discussion. And this is an effort for us to be part of that discussion without trying to usurp the governor's authority to do this between different states. So it's a kind of unique situation.
Senator Betzel?
Not convinced, Madam Chair.
Not convinced. All right, Senator Betzel?
I'm open to suggestions, but I'd move this to strike Section 2.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
If you really want to have a long discussion about the merits of Section 2, then, Madam Chair, I think you're personally, I think that's outside the purview of this committee. And I also think you're going to have to allow testimony on the merits of what the principles are. And we're going to be debating all of the different elements of these principles in your committee this morning. So I'm not sure that, that's really, Madam Chair, what you would intend for this committee to do. I know that that discussion will come up in subsequent committees, and it certainly come up in previous committees that are looking at the merits of these principles. But I don't think that that should be decided in this committee, I would, with all due respect.
Senator Betzel?
Well, again, Madam Chair, I don't know that the legislature finds these things that are in here. It's the intent of the legislature that it do this. I just get very uncomfortable. There was a recent appellate court decision that was, revolved around the fact that, we made some, legislative findings and so forth, which is, these are not. But as I say, yes, this is not quite within the expertise of this committee, but I don't know why we would need something in the bill to basically tell us, what we think the outcome ought to be here. This is a controversial issue. If this is what the group wants to discuss, I think they can bring forth these issues. Now, this is not a codified one part is. Section 2 is going to be codified. So I'll renew my motion.
Beg pardon? You renew the motion?
Yes. Madam, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson, even though our express jurisdiction is certainly dealing with the guidelines and adding legislators as an advisory group, which we've just done, I respect the privilege of any member offering an amendment. So we do have the Betzel amendment before us. Senator Gerlach, do you want to speak to the amendment?
I would like to speak to the amendment. Okay. I think Senator Betzel is correct in his assessment. I'd like to speak in favor of the Betzel amendment. This is not a brand-new issue for our committee. We oftentimes have this. I mean, this is a recurring discussion about whether we have legislative intent or findings or principles or purpose or whatever it is. They tend to be more political statements and such, and our statute books should be statements of fact. And it's certainly appropriate to have these types of things in the testimony, in the record, all those sorts of things. But if we were to proceed every one of our statutes with statements, we know we've had this discussion before, our statute books would be two and three times as large as they are. It's this type of information it's appropriate to be part of the discussion, but it's not appropriate to have it codified in the statute books. I think Senator Betzold is entirely correct. I think we should just remove Section 2. The bill's going to continue on and be debated, the substantive issues of it, and I don't know that it's appropriate to have the principles in the statute. So I think we should support the Betzold amendment.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Anderson?
Madam Chair, when you requested this bill to be brought into your committee, you stated that this would be based on the discussion about this advisory group. And I don't even have witnesses here to debate the substance of these principles. Senator Betzold, what you are doing is saying that the decision-making process that went on in the Environment Committee and the Energy Policy Committee is to be superseded by this committee when it comes to decisions about what we believe in the legislature a cap-and-trade process should include. These are not outcome principles. These are guiding principles to look at the front end, because it's very clear that there will be a lot of give and take and there will be a lot of detail. A model rule is being negotiated. And it's clear that that model rule will go into a level of detail that goes way beyond these statements. These statements are intended to be a broad statement of what principles should guide the negotiations. And if we remove them, then what we're doing is saying, Governor Pawlenty, you may negotiate a regional cap and trade process and bring it back to the legislature without any input from the legislature in an official way. And I find that disturbing, that we're ceding legislative input and letting the executive branch make all of these decisions without legislative input. It's an unusual process because we're talking about a state-to-state agreement. It's like a compact, presumably, that will be brought back to us. But what we're saying here is that we have some opinions, and we'd like the governor to keep those in mind in the negotiating process. If we remove those, we will not say anything of the sort. Honestly, these principles, we've spent many hours negotiating them, changing them. I've made a number of concessions on the substance of these principles in between the various committees, and the words have been vetted quite thoroughly in terms of their substance. So I really would object to the committee making a decision. I mean, you can argue about the form, but I don't believe the substance really, it would be appropriate to remove the substance that's been, we spent many hours discussing in the appropriate policy committees. And so, Madam Chair, I guess if you are going to move forward on this motion, then I would like to start the testimony, and you're going to have, I know, a lot of testifiers on both sides of the merits of these principles. So if you'd like me to do that, I have one witness. I wasn't prepared to bring witnesses to discuss the merits of the principles because I was told that wouldn't be part of this discussion today. So we'll do the best that we can.
Senator Betzel?
Just a response, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, first of all, I think legislators are going to be on, you know, this advisory group that's going to be talking about this. So the legislature, you know, there's going to be some representation. As I read Section 2, it says it's the intent of the legislature. If you wanted to read the intent of the Environment Committee, I guess we can say it that way. But you're binding all of us by this. And I don't know whether this is what the legislature wants or does not want to do. But you're saying the legislature, based upon a previous committee, has to abide by these principles. And you're saying not only this committee, but the rest of the legislature doesn't have a say in that. And I don't think that that's quite exact. You know, maybe another committee liked it, but, you know, I'm not bound by that.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Betzold,
obviously
you'd have to approve this overall bill when it comes to the Senate floor. I just don't think that this committee should be debating the principles on what a cap and trade should look like. I just don't think this would be the time to express your opinion on that piece of this bill. That's with all due respect, I think that it's outside the jurisdiction of this committee, and that's my only objection. Obviously, we will have a very vigorous debate about that in other committees that are related to the substantive parts of these principles and on the Senate floor. But I just would argue that that's not part of the hearing that should happen. I mean, you're the chair, Madam Chair, and you have to make that decision. I don't.
Senator Anderson, I there are no amendments that are out of order in a committee, even when we are directed toward a particular jurisdiction. I'm not going to support Senator Betzel's motion, but I cannot rule it out of order.
And, Madam Chair, just one more point, if
Senator
I may.
Senator Anderson.
That, Senator Betzold, you said that legislators will be part of this process. I've asked us to appoint legislators to observe and give advice, but they have no formal role in the process, and the governor does not have to include us in his negotiations. And I assume he will not include us in his negotiations. I'm just asking that they be allowed to attend meetings and be there, but I don't think we have the power to require legislators to participate in a way that is meaningful in the way that you suggest. They are not going to be negotiating this regional agreement, and they have no legal right to do so. So that's what concerns me.
Chair.
Senator Marty.
I don't disagree with you or Senator Betzold that he has the right to offer the amendment, but I think Senator Anderson's point that if he wants to do this, it would be more appropriate for floor fight to press it there because, again, it is – you have the right to offer here, but I think it would be more appropriate since she was not prepared for that, was not expecting this, and it is a policy thing that should be decided in energy and environment.
Madam Chair, I will withdraw the amendment. However, Senator Anderson, let me ask a couple of other questions if I'm permitted to do so.
Absolutely.
On page 2, line 11, you have a report due on December 1st, 2008. Now, the House is going to go through an election process. I don't know whether the people, the members of the House, are going to be in place to properly receive the report. I don't know who's going to hold what positions. So is December 1, 2008 an appropriate date for this report from the Commerce and Commissioner of PCA to submit to the chairs and ranking members when we may not, they may or may not be the people in place at that time? Is that a good date for them?
Senator Betzel, would you, again, just
page 2, line
citation.
11. By December 1, 2008, the Commissioner of Commerce and Commissioner of PCA shall submit a report to the chairs and ranking members of the Senate
see
House of Representatives.
Thank you.
There's an election in the House.
Senator Anderson, response to the concern about the early reporting.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I appreciate your withdrawing your amendment. I think you make a good point about the date, and we could certainly adjust
Madam
that.
Chair, I'll move that on page 2, line 11, insert January 15, 2009.
Senator Betzel moves on page 2, line 11, delete December 1st, 2008, insert January 15th, 2009. Is there any discussion of that amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel.
Page 3, line 18, the results of a study reported by January 1st, 2009, which is New Year's Day. I move to change January 1st to January 15.
Senator Betzel moves on line 318 to delete January 1st and insert January 15th. Senator
Madam Chair, I should have caught that. I appreciate that suggestion.
One more.
Any discussion on that amendment? All those in favor of the motion to amend line 318, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel.
Page 4, line 27.
Page 4, line 27.
Strike
same
January
motion.
1st, insert January 15th.
Line 427, delete January 1, insert January 15th. Senator Anderson?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the Betzold motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion? Senator Gerlach and Senator Anderson, I do think that, although, you know, I support your bill and I have indicated that to you, I too am uncomfortable and will be looking very closely at Section 2 when it comes to the floor. I have, just as a matter of basic policy, regardless of the content, an objection to purpose, intent, or findings being part of the codified statutes in Minnesota. We just don't do that, no matter how strongly I might support your bill otherwise. I would not have supported Senator Betzel's motion here, but if he makes it on the floor, I'm going to be looking very carefully at it, even though I support your bill. Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, I am quite disappointed that Senator Betzel withdrew his motion. I didn't follow the logic when Senator Marty said, well, it's more appropriate for the floor. I guess I didn't understand that this is a committee. We're due to do committee work here. The bill is before us. We know that it is inappropriate to put the commentary, as you just said. It should be no different whether it's in committee or on the floor. We should do this type of work in the committee so that when the bill gets to the floor, it is as ready as possible. To bring that forward onto the floor is unnecessary. We know that you should not place political commentary, whether it's called intent or principles or any of the any of those words. It is inappropriate to have that in our statute books. If we pass this bill out of here like that, we're essentially saying that it's okay to do that, and that's wrong. And I know that you believe that. You just said that you did, and I know that Senator Betzold is obviously conflicted on whether or not he wanted to withdraw the amendment. I think you know that we shouldn't do that. If Senator Marty can explain why it's appropriate to take this issue to the floor again, we're not debating the value or the idea of the principles. What we're discussing right here is whether or not it's appropriate to have it on the stage. So if Senator Anderson has witnesses or what she was talking about, we want to hear about their take on whether or not it's appropriate to put that in the bill, not on the value of the principles and that argument. We're talking about whether it's appropriate to put in there, and I am very close to offering the amendment, unless Senator Marty can tell me why this is more appropriate for the floor.
Senator Gerlach, I think that Senator Anderson was at the point of trying to argue, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the kinds of principles and intent, whatever, that you were suggesting for this bill is a little bit different than the kinds of proposals that we have had, that we usually have, of that in purpose language where it says, the legislature finds that apple pie is wonderful. I mean, it's not that kind of – it doesn't come with that kind of history. But Senator Anderson what I would suggest is that you take a look at language that uses words like intent and principles and find another way of stating it that gets to the same goal that you wish to get in this bill, because I think it's going to raise red flags for a number of people, even those that support your legislation. But Senator Marty, you want to respond to Senator Gerlach?
Madam Chair, a couple of things. One, I don't disagree whether it should be in statute or whether it just it doesn't need to be codified in my mind. But Senator Gerlach, the point that I was trying to make is that the policy committees that deal with these came up with this language for doing it. I think this is the different type. There are several reasons we put findings and things like that into statute, often to indicate to the court what the legislature is thinking and so on. Senator Betzold's right that he may not agree with what these findings are. I'm saying that's where we fight it out on the floor. I just think that this committee, and as I said, I think you or he have the right to offer it here. I just think that that's a fight that should be – it relates to those policies. And we all are dealing with all of that on the floor. We just often in a committee like this try and limit it to the things that deal with the committee. But you do have the right. I don't disagree.
Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to say that I hear this committee's advice loudly and clearly, and I'll have to make some adjustments to this bill. It's very clear before I bring it to the floor, and I appreciate that.
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, might I suggest that it be better to send this bill out without Section 2, and that instead of sending a bill with a flaw out of this committee that we know is wrong, we take that out, and then a proposal, if there's a fix, can be proposed to be put in on the floor if that's necessary, rather than send a flawed bill forward. Doesn't that make more sense? And isn't that doesn't that reflect that our committee has done its due diligence?
Senator Anderson?
Well, Madam Chair, I think I would request the committee not do that, just simply because I'd probably have to go back to the Environment and Energy Committees to bring new language back that would restate this. And I don't know. I just don't think it would be helpful at this point. It would be very difficult to do that. And I think that would be tantamount to killing this bill to do that at this point in time.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Gerlach.
Probably a significant overstatement if you take out the commentary that it kills the bill. I think that's an excessive overstatement. But I think it's wrong for us to send the bill out here, but I'm counting heads, and I can see that it wouldn't pass, so I'm not going to do an amendment that is futile. But we know that it's wrong to send this bill out with political commentary on it and then just punt it to the floor. I'm disappointed that our committee is willing to do that. We are certainly cutting corners on this. It's inappropriate, and we're going to see more of this, and then people will be splitting hairs on, well, this is different than the purpose because it has some extra value to it, and we are opening up the floodgates, and it's wrong for us to do that. So I'm disappointed that Senator Betzel, which was his amendment, it compromises the integrity of our committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I've just asked Senate Counsel to prepare a floor amendment to delete Section 2. So we'll have the opportunity.
But we'll lose that vote on the floor. I can guarantee that.
I will fight hard for it.
I can guarantee we'll lose it. So.
Well, I actually find myself torn by your comments and your criticism of the committee, but I also
constructive criticism. Constructive criticism.
No, I know. I'm not offended by it, or I'm not personally offended by it. But I do think that Senator Anderson was not prepared to defend whether there should be principles or intent, legislative intent, before this committee, and she now knows that she will have to defend it, and I'm not sure that it's a slam dunk vote on the floor, Senator Gerlach. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I would agree with you that I don't know that that's a slam dunk. I agree with Senator Betzold, yourself, and Senator Gerlach that the principles we've, in the years that I've had to vote on principles being in a bill, I've always voted to take them out because they're not appropriate. And so, and then there's a way to change that, and that's to make them law. And to say instead we should think about doing this, which is say any agreement requires that this happens. And I don't know all of what it would take to do that, but what is clear to me is that creating purposes, intents, and principles in legislation isn't appropriate and has never been appropriate since I've been in the legislature. And I agree that we shouldn't pass that into law.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, the bill as originally drafted was more implementation language. And so this is, again, the product of many, many hours of negotiation, amendment, and changing the bill. And so now I find it in a position where I have a problem, a different problem that I'm facing in terms of trying to get support for the bill as drafted. And it's not one that I mean, I understand where you're coming from. I understand the objection. I don't argue with you about our tradition and our history in that area, but I would suggest that the policies are so closely interrelated with the form of this that we would be embarking on a whole debate about the intricacies of energy and environmental and economic policy to delve into that question today. I think that I do need to fix it, and because it's evolved to create this problem as a result of negotiations and discussion on the substance, the policy questions related to cap and trade. And so I just think that it would be really unfair to the proponents of this bill of what we're trying to accomplish to have that form and substance be mixed together into a debate right now when we're not prepared to have that, and I don't know that your committee really wants to have that.
Is there further discussion on Senate file 2818? Senator Day.
I don't want to even get much in the debate, but this whole bit about I'm not prepared to discuss it here, but I'm prepared to discuss it on the Senate floor, that one is flying. I mean,
Madam Chair, this
Senator
bill,
Anderson.
I believe, is scheduled for Senator Metzen's committee on Monday. So I'll be prepared to discuss it on Monday,
okay,
and at the next committee stop, where certainly there will be a very vigorous debate about this. So, I just I'd appreciate that.
Is there further discussion on 2818? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in addition to those we've heard in favor or opposed to Senate File 2818 at this point, limited to the advisory group or Section 2, because that is what has come up here? Senator, but let me just ask for the public, is there anyone else? Seeing none, Senator Betzel.
Just a brief statement, Madam Chair. The there may be a lot of proponents, you know, who supported some of this. I wasn't part of it. I'm not bound by it. So I just have to – I think they have to understand it. So.
Yep.
Quick question.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick procedure question. What is the motion before us? This is going to go to
Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2818 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay. Madam Chair, question. This bill was referred to us. Was it with recommendation or without?
Referred.
And referred to the Committee on Business Jobs and Industry.
Okay, Madam
Chair,
just
the motion.
My question, was this bill referred to us with from the previous committee with recommendation or without?
That's correct.
It was without or with?
With.
Okay.
From the Energy Utility
Senator Prentice Solon's committee passed this bill on.
Committee.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I would like to move to amend Senator Lori's motion, since there clearly is some discussion about Section 2. I think our committee is being negligent by sending this bill forward with Section 2 in it, but I would like to amend his motion to without recommendation.
Okay, that is a higher
motion.
Yes, beg pardon?
It's an amendment to...
Yes, I know.
Motion, yes.
And that is a higher motion, so we will act on Senator Gerlach's motion to send the bill out without... recommendation. Is there a discussion of the amendment to Senator Lori's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Gerlach's amendment, a motion to amend that the bill be referred without recommendation, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We now have Senator Lori's motion before us at Senate File 2818, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to Senator Metzen's committee. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank
you
very much,
Senator
Anderson.
Chair and
I think
members.
You have your work cut out for you. The next bill we're going to take up is Senate File 2498.
Of course.
2948. Senator Larson.
How about
this? Thank you. Only half an hour late. Back.
She better thank you.
Yeah, I know.
You saved her big time.
Senator Larson, Senate File 2498, it's a repealer. You want to explain what's being repealed on the introduced version? If members turn to the back of the page, 1R, the part of the statutes that is being proposed to be repealed is printed for us. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2948 repeals a provision in law that provides for what is called final offer total package arbitration. Sometimes members, this is referred to as baseball arbitration, where the decision maker is required to choose either the employer's position or the employee's position. There is no middle ground allotted to the latitude allowed to the arbitrator. There is no ability to do anything but make that stark choice. In different experiences since this law was enacted, the experience is somewhat mixed. But there have been cases that I think really highlight why we should allow for traditional arbitration to occur. And one that I would point out is a case in East Grand Forks where the arbitrator actually wrote that he would have chosen the union's position, but the union had incorrectly submitted its final position, which could not have been changed after the submission was made, the arbitrator couldn't implement that because it was in violation, the proposal was in violation of the law. Therefore, even though the arbitrator would have chosen the union's position, if he would have been able to change some technical parts of it, he was forced to choose the other side. That sort of inflexibility, it seems to me, Madam Chair and members, is not something that we ought to move forward with. In many ways, just like we do here in the legislature, we find two proposals to a solution, and sometimes the best one is somewhere in the middle. And so I would like to I recommend that we make this change and allow arbitrators more flexibility rather than just providing this stark choice that we currently have in law. I have with me, Madam Chair and members, Tom Thornburg, who is the president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and he'd like to provide testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Thornburg, welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself, please, we'd be happy to have your...
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name's Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. We do not believe that firefighters should be treated differently than other essential employee unions. Our association had many questions and reservations about this experiment, and last year we voted to seek repeal of this law. We think it unfairly singles out firefighters. We also think it's just bad public policy. As Senator Larson pointed out, the current system has hurt many of our smaller locals. These locals have had many cases, a lot of these locals have very few members. East Grand Forks is an example. The members, as the senator said, wrote a final offer that contained an illegal term, and the arbitrator was forced to choose the city's position in that, even though he told the union he would have gone with the union's position. Just last December, Faribault, another one of our smaller locals, had a similar bad result. The parties could always agree to find, they could agree to use a final offer arbitration if they wanted to, but I don't think that it should be forced upon on the parties. The Minnesota Professional Firefighters believes that final offer total package is just not good. In this political election year, it's like winner take all, and that's just not always the best result. I've listened to this committee in earlier discussions, and amendments were offered, and unfortunately, when we get into arbitration, we're not able to offer amendments. You can offer amendments and get things passed. We can't do that in arbitration. If you were under the same circumstances, you wouldn't have very good results. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Are there questions for Mr. Thornburg? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to this bill? Ms. Kushner, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Laura Kushner. I am the Human Resources Director for the League of Minnesota Cities, and part of my job there is to advise cities throughout Minnesota on employment and labor relations issues. I am here today to state the League's opposition to Senate File 2948, which repeals the default option of final offer total package arbitration for firefighters. When the law was changed several years ago to make this the default, I think by the Professional Firefighters Association, cities weren't too sure that was a good idea. We didn't really know what to expect. Now we are satisfied that final offer total package is good labor negotiations. It basically encourages both sides to bargain and bargain hard so that an agreement is reached, and we think that that's good labor negotiation policy. It sets up a contingency that discourages arbitration, and I think, I apologize, I wish I had the statistics to show you, but my member cities have told me that firefighter arbitrations are down substantially since this became law several years ago. So this means that the union's best shot at getting what they want is during negotiations and not during arbitration. And it means that the employer shouldn't be asking for unreasonable takebacks either. So both parties have to bargain hard, and that's why we think arbitrations are down as a result. So basically, our testimony is that we think final offer total package works, and we'd like you to not take it away from us.
Other questions or comments from Ms. Kushner? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify with regard to this bill in the audience, either in favor or in opposition? Seeing none, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 2948 be recommended to pass.
Senator Larson moves that Senate File 2948 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Larson.
You. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman. Senator Vickerman brings us House File 2929. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, what this bill does, it authorizes a political subdivision of the state to give money or make in-kind gifts to nonprofit organizations if the grant is for a public purpose and is to support an educational, social service, health, or other charitable purposes. This bill also requires that the proposed gift be presented at and voted on at a regularly scheduled meeting of the governing body. Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Senate Counsel to give the definition of a political subdivision so everybody knows what we're talking about.
Well, Madam Chair, there is no general definition of a political subdivision in Chapter 471, so I have an amendment that would clarify that it is cities, counties, and townships. I think that's the intent.
Council, do you have the amendment? Thank you. This is an author's amendment. This is the first place this bill has been heard. It is the A1 amendment. Senator Vickerman moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted so that it's very clear what is meant by your bill, what the division, what a political subdivision is. So we have Senate File 2929 as amended before us. Is there are there questions for Senator Vickerman? Is there anyone who wishes to testify either in opposition or in support of the bill?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I would ask a question. What brought this up? Was there a situation that happened that brought this to our attention?
Senator Vickerman?
Madam Chair, I have Jeannie Fox here who can explain it faster and better than I can because we are going to run out of time here this afternoon. So
Ms.
if she
Fox,
would, she could answer
if you would identify yourself,
Council.
Please, for the record.
Yes,
you,
thank you.
Be, you don't need to read your testimony. If you'd be responsive to Senator Betzold's question, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Yes, Senator Betzold, we began – I'm sorry, I'm Jeannie Fox, Deputy Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And we began to hear from different both – county level and municipal decisions where nonprofits had either been seeking funds or had been granted funds to later have them rescinded because of kind of a what I would consider a patchwork of individual bills that exist that name certain organizations or certain types of organizations. And so elected officials were kind of struggling with, well, does this organization fit this list or not? And we don't want to encourage, you know, 4,500 organizations in Minnesota to come forward with their own individual bills. We'd like to just leave the local authority with the elected officials who are familiar with their community and the organizations within their community and let them make the decisions about what to fund. I will add that this bill refers to a specific type of nonprofit, charities, 501c3 organizations, where they are granted federal income tax exemption by the IRS due to the fact that they serve charitable, religious, scientific, or educational purposes, and that they ensure that no part of the income generated by the organization goes to any the benefit of any one person. So I would ask your support for this bill. I think it's a matter of choice, a matter of equity, and the language is permissive. Local officials can deny requests as well, but that we leave the decision-making to those in the community. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just
Senator Betzel.
The language of the bill indicates that it could, must support an educational, social service, health, or other charitable purpose. So that seems quite broad. So it strikes me that almost anybody who's got a 501c3 status would probably qualify for almost anything here.
Ms. Fox, or
sure.
Ms. Vaughn?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the court has defined public purpose here. Note that the requirements are that it be a C3 exempt charitable organization and that it meet a public purpose. The Supreme Court notes that courts generally construe public purpose to mean such an activity as will serve as a benefit to the community.
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
Point is that any organization that has 501c3 status can probably say that they qualify as educational, social service, health, or other charitable purpose. I mean, as long as you've got 501c3, you can make the argument that it fits. That's my point, is that, you know, it's almost anybody is going to qualify. Is that your reading of it, too?
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Yes, of course.
Senator Betzel, being a C3 in and of itself would not qualify under this. It has to also meet a public purpose. I think I understand your feeling is that is broad. Again, local officials have the ability to deny these requests as well.
But, Madam Chair, again, I'm Senator just pointing Betzel. Out that I think that if you've got a 501c3, anybody with any kind of creative mind can figure out a way to say it's educational, social service, health, or other charitable purpose. Anybody who, you know, can use this language to say, you know, it works. So that's just my only point here.
I think, Senator Betzel, however, that sometimes 501c3s can benefit an individual, even if it is within their mission statement, and this would not allow that. Have to be a public purpose, not supporting some individual. Is that correct, Ms. Fox, or do I don't understand the law?
Madam Chair, organizations generally are not organized around a mission to serve one person.
Make-A-Wish Foundation
serves several people,
or it could serve a single individual and still be
a C3, as does a mental health agency, for example, serves several individuals typically, correct?
Further questions? Anyone in the audience, in addition to Ms. Fox, want to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 2929? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman renews his motion that Senate File 2929, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members
Senator
of the committee.
Senator Lori, we're going to go back now to your 3098. We do have the amendment. And even your bill as amended, which will take into account the provisions of Senate File 3171 in your delete everything amendment. There are civil penalties in the bill. It will need to go to judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So we adopted the amendment.
Well, we did, but, you know, we really didn't.
Would you like me to move it again?
You were the only one that had it.
That's so fine. I will move it again.
Right. We're gonna do this properly and reconsider the motion by which the AO8-1228 amendment was adopted. All those in favor of that motion, then that's Senator Lori's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is now before us for reconsideration. This is an author's amendment. We do now all have it. Senator Lori moves that the AOA 1228 amendment be adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have the Delete Everything Amendment 1228 to Senate File 3098 before us. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the patience with this bill. Back to where we started. Again, this this bill covers both the Gambling Control Board provisions that they've been looking for and the allied charities, the charitable organizations. It also has support by the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. The bill does include technical changes to clarify regulations and a revised civil penalty provision, which, you, as you mentioned, will send us to judiciary. It's important to note that this provision is supported by the charitable industry as well. It also includes a temporary allowance or a little bit of relief from the current expense limits. I'll step through the bill. Again, I'll start from Section 1 since we didn't have it before. Sections 1 and 2 both simply clarify what a promotional ticket and manufacturing standards are. Section 3, still on page 1 of the amendment, allows temporary increase of 5% in the expense limits for 1 year due to the fiscal impact from both the economic downturn and the smoking ban that that has resulted in charities seeing a drop in their sales. And as we all know, there is a study that the Gambling Control Board is working on to delineate exactly what the effects have been. Section 4 on page 2 of the amendment modifies the civil penalty imposed for exceeding expense limits and allows for an exemption from the penalty due to extraordinary circumstances. So the Gambling Control Board has some flexibility in working with those penalties. Section 5, still on page 2, allows charities to share bingo equipment, and this is a provision intending to save the charities some expenses. They were requesting this, and it seems reasonable. Section 6, on page 3 now of the amendment, allows distributors to sell promotional tickets. Sections 7, 8, 9, and 10 on pages 4 through 6 of the amendment clarifies educational requirements for gambling managers. It's this has just been needing to be done for a little while. Section 11 on page 6 of your amendment, if you're trying to step through, clarifies who can play bar bingo. It essentially allows immediate family members and employees of the bar to play, whereas they couldn't before, provided they are not involved with the sale or the conduct of the bingo game itself. Section 12, still on page 6, allows for an electronic bingo device to be used for linked bingo games. Currently, only the old style of paper bingo with the dauber is allowed, and this electronic one would help some of our charities move forward into the new century. Section 13, on pages 7 through 9, rather a lengthy provision, is simply a housekeeping change allowing for 32 ticket tip board games, whereas it used to be 30, and 32 is an industry standard that makes a good deal of sense. Section 14 on page 9 now of the amendment clarifies when cash banks can be commingled with a dispensing device. They can be allowed to be commingled, and again, the Gambling Control Board is okay with that one. Sections 15 and 16 on page 10 clarifies the credit terms for distributors and charities. For some reason, it had been 35 days forever, whereas almost everybody else in the state is 30 days net, and so that's what we're changing it to here. Section 17 on page 11 removes the annual limit for progressive bingo games but keeps the limit at $2,000 per organization. Still on page 11, sections 18 and 19 clarify pull tab and tip board prize limits based on the cost per ticket. So as the cost of the tickets increase, the total amount of prizes can increase as well. Sections 20 and 21, still on page 11, remove the annual limit again for raffle prizes, but maintains a per prize limit capped currently at $50,000, and that $50,000 does not change. The rest of the sections, all on page 12, section 22, is a housekeeping change. Again, allows for 32-ticket tip board games, like section 13, back a little ways. Section 23, another housekeeping, prize payout limit per game, not per deal. We'll offer, you know, folks can ask questions on this if they want to. But Section 24 requires the Gambling Control Board to study all operational procedures and lawful gambling activity and their use of funds and provide a report with recommendations and proposed legislation focusing on cost-saving opportunities. The board will also get input from the industry, including representatives from revenue and public safety. This is a very important provision for the charitable gambling industry itself. They complain a great deal, and with a fair amount of reason behind their complaints at many of the administrative burdens. But there doesn't appear to be any real consensus as to how to appropriately relieve some of those burdens without removing our ability to allow the Gambling Control Board to have power they need to enforce our provisions. So I think it's widely recognized that there is some ability to move forward on some of these relief measures, and the Gambling Control Board is going to take the lead on seeing to it that those are laid out in a thoughtful manner for us to consider at a later date. I've got Tom Barrett from the Gambling Control Board and King Wilson from Allied Charities here to answer questions. I don't think we'll open it up for testimony unless there are questions of the members. Again, we know of no opposition to this bill. It has been worked on for a good long time, and I'm glad to be here without any opposition.
Are there questions for Senator Lurie? Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, and members, I'm looking at Section 9, lowering the tax. I know why you're doing it, because they can't afford to pay the 3-to-1. I'm just kind of curious if I'm the only one that noticed that, or is there a reason for that?
Section 9.
I'm sure there is, Senator Lurie.
Section 9 deals with training of gambling managers.
What was the amount of
local
taxes that may be charged for 9 cities at first class from 3% to 1? I would just
Senator Bickerman, that section was removed from the bill with the delete everything amendment.
Okay.
Sorry for the confusion. Yes, if you're trying to follow along, I don't think there is a Senate Council and Research memo on the delete all. There's a Senate Council and Research on each of the two bills that are being combined here today, and there are a couple of provisions that were causing some heartburn. That was one of them, and it has been dropped in an effort to reach the compromise we have today.
Any other questions? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lurie. And maybe this is a question for Mr. Wilson. I like the provision, Section 3. Is that enough time? Is that extension enough time, or the 1 year period enough time, or, you know, should we be phasing that out longer? I understand we don't want to just grow that on into the future, but, you know, it occurred to me maybe we should have thought about, you know, a 5 year period where we sort of go out there and then scale it back each year. But that's on the fly, but I just want to make sure we don't have the 1 year and then drop back and the clubs are in trouble.
Mr. Wilson, if you'd identify yourself, please.
Will do, Madam Chair. King Wilson, Executive Director of Allied Charities Minnesota. Madam Chair, Senator Larson, that provision was something that, as we did the negotiation with the Gambling Control Board, we looked at a number of different things, and I think there had been some thought to do it longer. We, in order to compromise and get something that we thought we could pass by the committee and the legislature, you know, we needed to find something reasonable. And I think the reason we settled on the 1 year is when you tie that with the study that's at the end, it is our sincere hope that as the study comes forward next legislative session, we will have found some things that will help us so that 1 year Band-Aid, which is what it is, will be something that won't be as problematic as it is now, or perhaps as we're doing the study, we'll find that maybe it does need to be looked at down the road. But we thought this was a practical compromise.
Any other questions? Senator Roebling?
Thank you. And on Section 11 with the bar bingo, and it just says that immediate family may participate, what is bar bingo? I guess I don't know how it works. Is it, do you actually pay and win prizes?
You want to explain Bar Bingo?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board, and Senator Roebling. Bar Bingo is, it's been around a while, but it's beginning to take on a whole new attention in light of things going on. We see bar owners trying to find ways to bring customers in, charities wanting to benefit. So a couple of years back when the charities were losing business across the border to North Dakota because they were allowing what they called noon hour bingo, that's when the focus shifted to what can be done in Minnesota. So as the board and then legislation that was passed allowed for some latitude for the conduct of bingo to be played in a bar setting with certain restrictions in terms of what could be allowed to go on. With that little bit of opportunity, customers do come in. They can enjoy their happy hour specials, whatever, but when it comes time for the bingo, they're sold bingo sheets just like you would in a bingo hall. There's a caller. It does get a lot more quiet in bars that are doing bar bingo, but they run a number of games, you know, 5-10 at the most probably. But it's a small, much more reduced scale, but it's similar if you've been to a location where they have meat raffles where it's a select group and they're kind of partaking in that. But it's proven to be very beneficial to those locations where the conduct is done appropriately. They're mindful of other customers, what's going on. But also the charities that are stepping up and doing the activity, it seemed to be a benefit to them, as well as bar owners. That's why we hear Minnesota Licensed Beverage supporting what's going on. And I will point out, regulatory-wise, this activity does not afford the bar owners any additional money in terms of rent. That was one of the provisions, that if they're going to do it, they might get added benefit from increased customers. But in terms of the charities, there wouldn't be an added cost expense to them to put on this. So it's run similar to what you would see. B1.
Senator Roebling?
No, I just didn't know. And but then do they still abide by
everything,
the caps
else,
and all the other rules for bingo that we have then?
Senator Laurie, do you have a further comment?
I'd like to speak, I guess, real quick to the question, too, and just what we're changing in bar bingo. It's important to understand what bar bingo is, but what we're changing is that the lessor's immediate family and employees may participate if they are not involved with the sale or operation of bar bingo. And I'd like to at least ask our rural members to think about walking into a bar and trying to determine whose relatives. and try to understand the Gambling Control Board's difficulty with that provision. And that's, I think, where this particular change in language, you know, they still can't participate. We're going to keep a clean game, but it's very difficult to enforce whose relatives in the bars, particularly in my area, I know. regarding relations.
Okay, are there any other questions for Senator Laurie or Mr. Wilson or Mr. Barrett? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in support or in opposition to Senate File 3098? Seeing none. Senator Laurie moves that Senate File 3098 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, we're going to move down to number 13 on the agenda. We have a witness who has some time constraint.
Welcome to the committee. Senate File 202 before us. Rather, Senate File 3190 before us.
I think it's 3202.
what I have.
3190. Oh, we are. Did we do another one? We didn't know. Which one? Combined. Are we done with everything on the first page?
Mr. Chairman, we have slightly different. I didn't mean to cause any confusion. I operating off a slightly different numbering list. The bill that I was referring to is number 13 on the list I'm looking at, and it's Senate File 3190. 3190 also needs to go to the Committee on Business Industry and Jobs, and it is a very simple proposition, and it allows, if you read along with me, a state employee to be granted leave from work with 100% of pay, not to exceed a period of 3 hours in any 12-month period to donate blood. And the leave must not affect the employee's vacation, leave, pension, et cetera, other kinds of time. And the employer, again, may grant that leave for a blood donation. And I would request that you hear from
Rick Panning.
Mr. Rick Panning, who is the CEO of the North Central Region of the American Red Cross.
Madam Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity today. Mr. Chairman, I apologize. As was stated, I am the Chief Executive Officer for the American Red Cross, the local blood region here located in St. Paul, and I'm here to talk in support of this legislation. As you know, the Red Cross and a number of private blood centers and organizations like the Mayo Clinic on a regular basis need to maintain a consistent blood supply for patients in our state. And just to give you a feeling for that, the American Red Cross currently in Minnesota collects about 240,000 units of blood a year. In addition, we collect about 40,000 other products, which are platelet products for people with bleeding disorders. And that is done in a variety of fixed sites and mobile locations in our state to provide blood over the entire state of Minnesota, western Wisconsin, and eastern South Dakota. The need for blood is consistent. Another bill that has gone through this legislature this session has to do with lowering the blood donation age to 16, but the purposes are similar. We need to try to increase the population that's available and provide the proper incentives for people to be able to donate blood. Unfortunately, we live in a time when, due to the regulations that we're under, only about 37% of all the people in the United States are eligible to give blood anymore. A lot of that's due to the traveling restrictions that have been placed on us by the Food and Drug Administration. And of that 37%, only about 5% of those people actually do donate. The need for blood increases all the time. If I didn't gain one new hospital customer for the rest of my career, the need for blood increases 3 to 4% every year. And we need to keep up with that. And unfortunately, the reality of our business is that the donor base, which is aging, like the rest of everything else, the donor base is aging and we have fewer donors and we have fewer donors entering that. The bill that we're talking about will benefit organizations like the Red Cross, of course, our colleagues at Memorial Blood Center here in Minneapolis and the Mayo Clinic. We're the three organizations that collect blood in Minnesota. And similar proposals have been passed in states like Illinois, New York, and Texas. To give blood, to give normal, regular blood, it takes about an hour, a little over an hour of somebody's time. To give platelets, which is a longer procedure, takes about 2 to 2.5 hours of somebody's time. And as was stated by Senator Ress, this bill would provide for paid time off for state employees to be able to do that and to set an incentive to be able to do that. In closing, I'd like to just make a couple comments One of my colleagues on our board of directors at the American Red Cross is a former colleague of yours, Majority Leader Steve Swigum, in the House of Representatives. He wanted wanted to be with us here today, but he had another commitment in Austin, and he was willing to testify with me. And then just before I came, Jan McDaniel, my counterpart in the Twin Cities chapter of the American Red Cross, she's the CEO over there, actually dialed in to Governor Pawlenty's Friday morning radio program to talk about this bill, and I wasn't able to listen to that, but she did send me an email to tell me that that had occurred and that Governor Pawlenty had stated that he thought that this sounded worthwhile, and she wanted me to share that with you today. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Panning.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
I did misspeak about where the bill was going to go.
Yes,
I still had
finance.
The previous request in my folder from Senator Metzen, and it would have gone from there to finance, but I'm informed by the committee administrator that Senator Metzen has requested the bill, and so my motion, when it's appropriate, will be that the bill be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Duly noted. Do any members have questions of either Senator Rust or Mr. Panning? Seeing none, anyone? Just Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, what is the purpose of Section 2?
Senator Rust.
You mean why does it add anything to Section 1?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, I would imagine that an employer already may grant paid leave. It's up to the employer. So I guess I don't know what the purpose is because they can already do that.
I'm going to refer to counsel why that is there. And it's not in the same section of the law as 43A-187. So it must be in a section of the law where there are any number of permissive subdivisions that allow, that specifically state where conditions under which an employer may grant paid leave. Mr. Bodden?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rust, you're right that this is codified in an area that's much broader application, and it would also apply to local units of government. Clearly, as far as private employers are concerned, if it's discretionary, it doesn't change anything. It might clarify something for local units of government.
Okay.
So, Senator Roebling,
Senator Rust.
In Section 1, it is stating that leave must be granted. In Section 2, for other units of government, it's saying that it may be granted.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. I thought it was private employers, not knowing which reference to the section of law it was, and I didn't understand the purpose.
I'd have to look at the statute. So, Mr. Bodden, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bodden, does it also, it's also discretionary anyway, Senator Roebling.
Mr. Bodden?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rust, is the question exactly which group of employers applies to? I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bodden, does 181 apply to private employers as well as
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rust, that's correct. It does. Of a certain size, I should clarify. I forget the exact cutoff. I think it's around 20 employees.
But at any rate, it is discretionary. Yes?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes. Yeah. Or Mr. Chairman, yes.
Make a comment.
My witness,
Mr. Panning.
I'd like just to make a comment again, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee. This, I believe, was put in there. I don't know any of the relation to what it refers to in law. But in other states, this is sometimes been broader, and I think this was to set the stage for the future. This could apply to private employers or other government entities. But in some laws that have been passed in other places, they have made it broader than state employees to require that. We're at this point just really supporting the fact that, as Senator Roebling said, many employers already do this. Of course, I, as the Red Cross, already do this. Why wouldn't I? But many employers, I've worked for healthcare organizations, already do this.
Oh, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Roebling.
She just The fight will come when you try and make this mandatory.
I'm sure of that. Yes.
Any other questions of members? It appears we have someone from the audience who would like to speak. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Pat Anderson, Dewar Commissioner, and we'd like to testify against the bill. We're handing out right now a copy of the AFSCME contract. The MAPE contract is identical. And first of all, I should say that this just came to our attention yesterday, so we were surprised to see this in the first place. I will maybe I'll turn over the contract part to Deputy Commissioner Paul Larson, who does the contracts and the labor negotiations for the state.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson. State your name.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations. In that capacity, I also serve as the state labor negotiator. Having just looked at this bill over the last 24 hours, it does give us some concern, but I would like to qualify by saying the state as an employer wholly supports the idea of their employees with respect to blood donation. We've dealt with blood donation for several years in the collective bargaining process. We provide for on-site blood donation programs in a lot of our large facilities, for example, the Centennial Building, mm-hmm. the other large locations, our correctional facilities, our veterans' homes, and so on. And we actually have language in our collective bargaining agreement that allows for paid time off for our employees to do that. What this bill would do is allow for paid time and for off-site donations for which we would have no control over. Now, obviously, this is still for the blood donation leave, but the concern that we have is our staffing of our 24/7 facilities, which is our really the heart of the discussions that we have with labor when we're in negotiations, because oftentimes in those facilities we're operating at the minimum staffing patterns as we are. And when you look at the language for the state section, it says must be granted, which means we have no discretion. We would have to grant the leave. I think we'd have to take a look and see just how broad this would be is if we start costing this, but it would probably cost us some overtime. There would probably be posts that wouldn't be filled, or there would be some issues to deal with this. And so I again want to emphasize we do have concerns about this, but I want to also point out that we have a very, in my opinion, comprehensive program for our state employees throughout the state that do allow currently paid time for on-site blood donation leave.
Mr. Chair, if you look at the language, and again, they're identical within each of the contracts, but it's donate blood in an on-site and appointing authority endorsed program. We have staff within my own department that give 3-4 times a year through the Red Cross, who comes into our building and runs a blood drive. And we've been doing this for many, many years. And so we were very surprised to see this bill. I also listened to the radio show this morning when the Red Cross person talked to the governor, and the governor said that he supports having paid leave in concept. He hadn't seen the bill for state employees, but he specifically asked the head of the Red Cross, said, would you bring it on site? Apparently the governor wasn't aware that we already do that everywhere. He asked specifically, would you bring it on site because it takes less time, and the Red Cross person said yes, that they would be pleased to do that. That's what we do currently. That's not what is in this bill. This bill, again, allows at any point in time, doesn't even need to be a sanction. We're not sure there are there are blood type of things that aren't really drawing blood. Is that, you know, I don't want to call it the plasma, but, you know, would that sort of thing fall under it, where people are getting paid? We think we have a very good program right now, and we don't understand why there would be any reason to change that or why we would be allowing employees to go off-site. And furthermore, I would think from the Red Cross's standpoint, they're going to have more people donating if they're coming here rather than having someone have to drive to Minneapolis or drive away from their work to donate blood. So that's our testimony.
Thank you for that. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Mr. Larson, I thought I heard you say a few minutes ago, though, that you have this at a lot of bigger locations. What about a small DNR office in Thief River Falls? Red Cross probably isn't going to go there, yet if they have a community drive, they're having a Red Cross drive in Thief River Falls, say. What's the difference? I mean, it may take them an extra 10 minutes to drive across town to give blood, but why should they? I mean, if this was available, if you could have if Red Cross or Memorial or whoever was able to show up at every workplace on a regular basis, I can see you wouldn't need this, but I think in some cases you have a need for this.
I can answer. Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that is in fact what we are currently doing in Greater Minnesota, where we have a larger population of state employees that exist as a group of employees, particularly in where we have the Department of Natural Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, and so on, and where we have sponsored those programs. It may not be in a site where you have four employees to one office, but where we identify what we consider regional locations, that even in those instances where the state has endorsed that, those people are on state time.
Mm-hmm. So,
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, what's the objection? I don't read that this must be granted. I mean, maybe you need an advance notice of a few days so you don't have, I mean, it's not like somebody can walk in, I'm leaving in 5 minutes and want to give blood. But it seems to me that this is flexible enough that you could say, yeah, we'll grant it to you, but we want a 3-day notice or something.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Larson.
Senator Marty, again, the emphasis on would be the employer makes, you know, the arrangements and works this out with the blood donor program for that. There's more latitude on that. The way, I'm unfortunately, in my position, I have to look at all of the possible scenarios to this, and I just don't see some of the relief that we have in there. It might be better, when I looked at the language in the bottom section where it says may be granted, that would be something that we could look at. But I want to emphasize that I think that as the employer with the executive branch that we are doing a very good job in the area of blood donation for our employees, and that in those instances where we've coordinated that, it is already on paid time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, okay. Ms. Anderson, I'm sorry.
Hey, I make another comment. This language is actually could be construed as more strict. That's what within our contract. 3 hours in a 12-month period, we would have to track the time. We'd have to create that as another leave category and track that time. Again, I mentioned that we have some employees, I have it within our own agency, that give, you know, 4 and 5 times a year, they claim, which would arguably be more than 3 hours. So we'd actually be restricting them. So in a, you know, one way, this would be a tougher for us to do, and we would also have to track the time specifically.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond?
Senator Rust, yes,
thank
please
you very
respond.
Much. Well, I find the department's objection to this really modest proposal baffling. And as to the notice that it's something that came up overnight, the bill was introduced over, what is today?
Today is March 7th.
Over a week ago. So it's not something that is just appeared out of nowhere. What the bill is saying is that there's 3 hours that must be granted. It doesn't say that you can't do it more than that if you want to, or that you can increase the amount of time off under a contract. It's just saying that this is at least one time for 3 hours in a 12-month period that state employees would have this would have this privilege. And certainly, I think Senator Marty's comment, if I would like to offer an amendment that would have with sufficient advance notice or even a specified time period, or that it would want to make some exceptions for emergency workers, I think that would be appropriate. We can certainly do that in this committee, or we can do it when it gets to finance to take a look at what the fiscal impact would be, if any.
Senator Marty, would you like to try to work
that
language out?
Yeah, I think I was going to say about the same thing. Yeah, this does not force you to limit them to 3 hours. You don't have to keep track of it. If you think an employee who's giving 4 or 5 times in a 12-month period, I think they should be thanked for that. But you only have to give them 3 hours off for it. I guess I don't see this as a big, heavy burden, and I don't think it's very restrictive at all. If we were to change it to May grant, that would be, well, of course, you can do that now. I just don't think this is something you have to, as Senator Rest said, they can negotiate more time for this, but this seems to be something you shouldn't have to negotiate for a chance to help somebody. I mean, when I've given blood, you know, I don't find it a lot of fun. You do it because you think it's the right thing to do, and I think the Senate, I don't know how many times. We have a blood mobile here often, I think, but I don't think anybody here is keeping track, and oh, you spent more than 3 hours there, but I just don't see that it should be any burden whatsoever for the state. It is time off. It is unpaid. It is you're paying somebody to do this because the state feels it's important and a priority to do that. So there is a loss of productivity there, but I think it's more than made up for in the community good that we want to promote.
May I respond?
Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you. We don't feel that the current system is a problem whatsoever. We don't track the time. We have the blood mobile come in as often as we possibly can. We encourage people to donate. We send things out to donate. We believe that this, because it's off-site, because it says not to exceed 3 hours, that this is much more restrictive and it's going to be harder to track than what we currently have, which is something that we don't track.
Senator Roebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is kind of a big deal when you think about it, because I bet most of our state employees earn at least an average of $20 an hour, so they get 3 hours at $60. That's a cost to the state for a pint of donated blood. And I give blood, and I'm a regular donor, and I've always, you know, found time to do it. But I guess I really have sympathy for those that have to have mandatory staffing levels. And I, you know, the prisons, the state nursing homes. Then we have another bill that says we're going to mandate how many patients a nurse can have, take care for on their shift. And we've got, you know, so we got levels for prison guards to inmates, and we have these standards that we have put, you know, we put in place that we expect them to maintain. And if anything happens during those times, if they're short shifted, you know that we're going to have a major problem or lawsuit or something. So at the least, if this is going to move forward, I do think we have to include language that they have to be able to provide advance notice in any of those kinds of shifts in particular where there's staffing level problems if somebody is missing. And I don't know, we just did something, Senator Russell, what were we doing in state government finance the other day where we were talking about this very issue of giving state workers time off? And there was something about at least a two-week notice because of when they're scheduling and doing shifts, you know, setting their shift schedule for the coming 2 weeks. We just were doing something. It wasn't related to blood, but it was some other issue. And And I'm trying to remember what it was.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebuck have indicated that I'd be open to an amendment, but I don't have access to the council right now. If somebody else does and wants to suggest one, that's fine.
Mr. Larson, is it?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, currently some of our provisions, and I'd be comfortable to say, if we change the schedule of our state employees in a lot of our collective bargaining agreements, within 14 days we have to pay them time and a half because of the penalty to do that. So if an employee, and where we have negotiated with unions on benefits such as this, if they give us a 14-day notice, then that will give us the ability to change someone else's schedule to accommodate that request at the straight time rate. And so that would be, I think, a reasonable compromise. 14 days notice, we can handle it.
Senator Marty, are you?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's reasonable. I mean, I think you could, I don't think this language would preclude you from requesting the advance, requiring the advance request anyway. I don't think at least I assume state employees can't give you I'm going to walk out the door now to give blood. I mean, I don't think they can do that for, going to walk out the door now for vacation time. I think they usually give notice, and I think you usually require it, but if that makes the department feel more comfortable,
Mr. Chairman, could you also give us language that would accommodate that?
Mr. Botter?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest is actually engaged in another conversation. I didn't hear the question.
We're looking for a requirement of a 14-day notice prior to the granting of leave.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, you could, on page 1, line 9, after the period, insert, an employee using leave granted under this section must provide at least 14 days of notice before using the leave.
That's fine. Mr. Chairman, I make that motion to amend the bill and that with that language.
Okay, the motion is before us. Mr. Bodern, could you repeat it just to make sure that it's recorded and everybody understands?
Mr. Chairman, the amendment would read as follows. On page 1, line 9, after the period, insert, an employee using leave granted under this section must provide at least 14 days of notice before using the leave.
Thank you. On the motion, any questions?
Just a
Senator Betzel.
Question, Mr. Chair. Typically, how far in advance do they know that the bloodmobile is going to be around? I mean, if you're only notified a week before it shows up, how could you give 14 days notice?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, this is not necessarily where the bloodmobile is but where someone, as the commissioner indicated, might be going off-site.
Okay.
That they would make a reservation to give blood at a blood bank 14 days in advance.
So this is a friendly amendment, correct?
And we have
it's your amendment, and we have it before us. Any other questions? All in favor of the amendment as described by Council Bodern? All in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion then that Senate File 3190 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 3190 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. On that motion,
more than half.
Any questions? Would anybody else in the audience care to speak either in favor or opposed to this bill? Okay, everyone understand the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, we want to we want to move on the bills that need to go to another committee, and I believe that another one of mine on there does need to go to the Judiciary Committee.
Yours?
And if I could take that one up now, I'd appreciate it.
I don't know what number it is. 2533 on gambling.
2533.
Pull that up. We heard that in the subcommittee on gaming.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the adoption of the subcommittee report.
Senator Rust moves the adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. We now have the bill before us.
Mr. Chairman, what Senate File 2533 does is to amend the definition of gambling device in the Minnesota Criminal Code by providing that a gambling device is such whether or not it's actually played. We had extensive testimony from Mr. Shields in the subcommittee. We have subsequently, because there was some confusion about what actually the enforcement would be with regard to this, met with representatives, or at least one representative of a major provider of casino games and casino nights, and have no objection to the provision now from them. And it's clear that what the law is doing is reasserting the conditions under which the gambling devices, the per se gambling device law, was enforced prior to a case some 18 months ago that called the law into question. So what the proposal is doing is re-clarifying the understanding of gambling device in the law. And, Mr. Chairman, this bill needs to go to the Committee on Judiciary. And I would move that Senate File 2533, and I don't believe it had been amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, did you adopt the subcommittee report?
Yes,
we did. Okay.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I oppose the bill in the subcommittee simply because I just think it's so restrictive. It actually is defining a gambling device that's inoperable even as one that is ineligible to be in a public establishment, basically. And I just think that it goes too far. They did say they could be viewed like a slot machine in a historical society or a museum, but that a restaurant couldn't have one there. And apparently this whole issue arose from a case in northern Minnesota. Here's the amendment. that where someone had one of these old slot machines and they were allowing patrons to pull the arm of the slot machine, and if they got like three cherries or three lemons, they would get a discount on their food at the restaurant. But my question is what is the harm in that if there is no wager made? That's what I continue to struggle with, because in order to have a bet, you have to have a wager. Or in order to gamble, to me, you need to have a wager. And in an instance like that, there is no wager. And so I just struggle with why we have to be so strict about it.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, as we explained in the committee, subcommittee, but obviously not to your satisfaction, why we have a per se law and why we're making sure that is being clarified. We're not really changing the law. We're just clarifying it. Is that you could have an inoperable slot machine sitting in a restaurant when the enforcement people walked in with the parts on the shelf that would make it operable, and as soon as they were 15 minutes down the line, you could make it operable again. And that is a problem for gambling enforcement. People that have slot machines operable or inoperable in their homes or in any private place like that, those are legal. That's not what is being talked about here, whether those machines are antique or not. I do have Mr. Shields here to further explain, and also the expert in his department to describe what the situation was that precipitated this clarification and why this is good public policy. Mr. Chairman, if I could have the testimony.
Yes. If I recall correctly, during the subcommittee hearings, not only was that a theoretical possibility, I mean, it was actually experienced where there were nearly functioning machines with some parts pulled out, and they found those on occasion with people saying that these weren't operational devices. But Mr. Shields, and offer your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Shields, I'm the director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. I'm going to defer here briefly to Special Agent Charge Willems, who has a lot of history, more than anyone probably left in the state on this topic. Briefly, point of history. Before, in 1963, when we amended the criminal code, the gambling definition of a gambling device was a laundry list. And the legislature and the wisdom decided, rather than each session, as one of these devices came upon the scene, keep adding to it, they came up with the generic term that's now in front of us in the statute, gambling device. That is when the per se argument that the device in and of itself, the inanimate object, becomes illegal. So for about 45 years or so, it has not been an issue until the last maybe 18 months or so, when it's been challenged, saying that the device in and of itself has to have the play to make it illegal. That does provide us an enforcement nightmare, because in the 1980s we had situations in bars where devices were allowed to be in the bars, and as soon as the agents would leave, the play began. So I think the legislature in about 1990 reinforced that and reinforced the per se argument. The unique aspect of the historical, I think we had some discussion, and on the rare occasion that has come up, we do permit those machines, put some in writing, and allow them to go into historical settings. But I'll defer to Special Agent Charles Willems to fill in the blanks and any more of the specifics of the law.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Willems. I'm a special agent in charge with the Minnesota Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. And as the director and Senator Rest have presented to you, the issue really stems from what has been kind of a change in the last 18 months or so of what we have considered kind of the historical view of what this definition means and how it applies to gambling devices within Minnesota. And it stems truly out of a circumstance coming out of one of the northwestern counties, slot machines in a restaurant, in part where they're being run and arguably using money provided by the owner of the business, and certain winning combinations afforded you certain discounts for the food. Now, that all sounds somewhat innocuous and those kinds of things, but in fact, people were using these devices, and then as the county attorney considered whether or not to take action with this, and in polling other county attorneys across the state whether or not this, in fact, was a gambling device, his opinion was the statute required a gamble to occur. And that has not been the way that the statute has been applied for some 45 years or interpreted for 45 years. It was for that reason that in conversations that we sought to see what is the policy and intent of the legislature with regard to gambling devices within Minnesota. We seek to do this in part because of getting this clarification will give us what your policy of intent is with regard to these devices and how we shall try to enforce this law. Our concern is this, that we simply do not have the staff to determine whether or not a gamble will occur on every device that we may run into in all of the public places that they can go across the state. It will take time. It will take effort. It will take a lot of man hours to determine whether or not the law has been violated by us waiting to determine the gamble has occurred. And again, this is different than the way it has been for the years past. And in doing that, you can imagine all the local venues where if you're not known, the gamble may be occurring, but because they do not know you, they may not pay off to you, that there's third-party kinds of things that go on with it. And it takes us back to those days of the video games of chance, which the director had alluded to in his remarks to you in the 1990s when the legislature moved video games of chance from 349 to the 609 statute, included a part of the gambling definition, and in fact was at that point still reaffirming the thought that a gambling device was a gambling device per se, and a video game of chance now was included in the gambling device definition because of all the problems that had occurred, and it was their desire that these devices not be in the public forum. They did allow for the sale of these devices. They do allow for them to be possessed. They do allow for them to be in persons' dwellings, but they do not allow for them to be in public places where they can be used or misused, as the case may be. So what we tried to do with this language was to clarify for ourselves and for county attorneys that the gambling device per se is still the intent and policy of the legislature within Minnesota with regard to these kinds of devices.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And apparently it is not clear in statute now, so the county attorneys have decided that the intent would be that a gamble occur, and they're seeking our true intention. It would be my intent also that a gamble occur. I guess, you know, we could do this for a lot of things. We could say, well, here's a gun, and we could say that it's obvious that people use guns to murder other people, so we're going to outlaw the guns. But that might not be what the gun is there for. There's just all these things we could go back to, but it isn't the inanimate object that causes the crime. It's the action. And to outlaw the inanimate object because an action might occur just does not seem like that would be our intention. And so,
Senator Roebling, if you had a pile of cocaine sitting in front of you, would you be guilty of a crime?
Guns in your nose? Is that
yeah. I guess I would be guilty of possession.
Two bills. Yeah.
Just an inanimate object. I think it's very different than the gun analogy.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, we have the motion of Senator Rust before us. Anyone from the audience that has not spoken already care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2533. Seeing
none. Mr. Chairman, then I would move that Senate File 2533 be recommended, passed, and referred to Judiciary.
We have the motion of Senator Rust that Senate File 2533 be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary before us. All in favor of that motion, aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, what is the next bill that we
the
need
next
to go
bill we
to,
are going to take
to
up
another,
while I still have the gavel is Senate File
committee.
3378 on county appointment process.
Okay. That needs to go to another committee?
No, I need to go to another committee.
I see.
If anybody will.
Over that. The attorney's over there. Oh, yeah, I have.
What's the fires?
Members, we are going to take up bills. We're going to take up this bill. We're going to take up bills that need to be referred to another committee. Otherwise, we'll beat until 3 o'clock, and any bill left then will just have to be taken up some other time. So that kind of gives you an idea of how fast we would like to move, unless there is lots of testimony. Senator Lurie brings us 33 78, and this bill is going to go to the floor if it's approved, because Senator Lurie has bills up in other committees. So, Senator Lurie, 3378.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will do my very best to be brief. I do have an author's amendment and an oral amendment to move. The author's amendment is the A2 amendment you should have before you.
We have the A2 amendment. This is an author's amendment. Senator Roebling moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Senator Lurie, apparently there are some additional changes to the A2 amendment, but we're going to adopt this so that we can talk about it, and
we will get them when they come.
Beg pardon?
Are we going to be here past 3? I can maybe go do my other...
No, we're not.
Okay. Then we need to press
on. We have the A2 amendment.
Thank you for your...
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie.
Okay. And then I have Senate Counsel is helping me. With another amendment.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And I can just read them if that.
You can read it?
Yes.
Okay, we can adopt it orally to the language that we have in front of us. Mr. McGowan.
Okay, Madam Chair, the first amendment, this is to the bill. Now, this is not in the amendment.
Right.
It would be incorporated in the author's amendment. Page 2, line 9.
We've actually already adopted that, so it'll have to be a second author's amendment. Page 2, line 9.
Page 2, line 9, delete, make a reasonable effort to.
Consult with.
So we are deleting on 2-9, delete, make a reasonable effort to.
Consult with.
Must.
Well, then the sentence would just read the BART also must with public officials.
You need to delete consult with also, do you not?
No. The board must also consult with public officials, would be how it would read.
It should read the board also must notify public officials in the district.
Madam Chair, I stand corrected. The amendment would be page 2, line 9, delete, make a reasonable effort to consult with and insert notify.
Okay. We understand that. Mr. McGowan.
Okay. The next amendment would be on page 2, line 33, delete persons residing in the ward or district in which the vacancy occurs and insert city residents.
City?
City residents.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the third amendment would be page 3, line 1, delete, make a reasonable effort to consult with public, and delete lines 2 through 4, and insert, notify the county auditor, period.
Is that clear to members? This is a separate author's amendment, and I'm just going to review it. On page 2-9, delete, make a reasonable effort to consult with, and insert notify. On 2-33, delete persons residing in the ward or district in which the vacancy occurs, and insert city residents. And on 3-1, delete must make a reasonable effort to consult with public, and delete lines 3-2, 3-3, 3-4, and insert notify the county auditor. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the second author's amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie, if you would now explain the bill as it's before us.
Okay. As some of us may remember, last year we allowed counties the authority to appoint upon a county board vacancy. There's some issues with how it was implemented. It allowed for an appointment for up to a two-year remaining period. There have been many people, residents, who believe that that is too long a period. We're restricting that so that only only 1 year of a term can be subject to the appointment process. And we are also calling for a little bit of a public process. It's not very prescriptive. You're going to have a public hearing upon a vacancy and notify people who live in the area represented and take some public testimony. This occurred, the need for this occurred in the county I reside in Pine County, where we did have a board resignation. And I don't think, it's not about Pine County, but at that same board meeting where the member resigned, there was an attempt to appoint a new member right then and there without any input from the public. That motion failed. There was a bit of a public process. The public process that occurred did still leave some with questions, but I think that the possibility of a board vacancy and an appointment, again, to particularly on the county board level, an appointment by four members who don't even live in the district that they're appointing another board member to represent is a very serious matter. And in working on this, we found that the cities ought to also be covered by this. We've worked hard with both the counties and the cities. I don't, you know, they may want to speak to the bill in one manner or another, but I believe that we've got consensus of all the parties. I'd like to, I've got two witnesses who have come from a long distance, Commissioner Carlson, Doug Carlson from Pine County, and a citizen who applied for the job of vacant county board member, Jeffrey Walker. I'd like to invite them up and request that they limit their testimony as much as possible, given that I'm kind of inserting myself into the agenda here. But it was something that, that really...
Yeah, if they would come forward, we'll have, you know, if you would make an extremely brief statement, either in support or opposition to the bill, that would be very helpful to our process this afternoon. Mr. Carlson, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Carlson, Pine County Commissioner from District 5. It's a real pleasure to be back in front of you folks. I see the body is still a deliberative body, and this bill is, first of all, I want to thank the staff and the senators for allowing us to testify and Senator Lori to bring it up. What transpired, you folks had changed the law a year ago, in I believe it was May, and we were the first one, a sitting commissioner resigned to accept the privilege of attempting to become one of our appointed hired staff people. Very well qualified, but the way the law was written, it went to the appointment process. I personally, and I'm here speaking on my own behalf, the board knows I'm here, and I told them I was not happy with what, not the individuals, none whatsoever, but the process. And what transpired, we then thought at the original thing we had to have an election. We then were informed, no, you could do an appointment. I failed on the vote because, and I happen to believe in elections, I thought the election was a fair way to go, but the law did permit appointment. The rest of the board members felt, avoid the cost of an election and appoint someone. My personal opinion is all members, we have each a vote, and what transpired, we ultimately ended up, and the general public was notified to say, notify the auditor, board members, or our county coordinator if you're interested in the position. We ended up with seven candidates, and none of the others, other than what the board ultimately voted on, were not interviewed. We're not, I don't believe we're even given a phone call. And I was not happy. The individual that got the job was very, very well qualified. Have no problem with that at all. I think we're dealing with a process, not individual board members. And so I appreciate you folks considering softening this or expanding it, whatever you want to call it, Madam Chair.
Do you support the legislation now as it's been amended?
It changed a little from what I was here, but yes, I support you folks attempting, and I'll be very brief, but I'll stand for any questions. Many of you have heard about Pine County. We try to split. We've had judicial problems up there, and but I appreciate the chance to, when seven people apply, I think we need to do something a little different.
Thank Commissioner you, sir. Carlson is correct. Pine County does shed a light on many issues that we need to think about hard down here. It's a long and proud tradition we have there.
Sir, if you'd J.J.
Waldholm
has
said
committee?
That he's going to bypass his testimony.
Oh, okay.
He was displeased with the process in support of this.
Sir, do you support the legislation?
Yes, I do. With what Doug said, I just agree with what he said. I was one of the seven, and I agree with what Senator Lori said.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate both of you joining us this afternoon. Are there questions for Senator Lori with regard to the bill? Seeing none, then Senator Lori moves that Senate file 3378. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Higgins. I'm from the League of Minnesota Cities, and the League has just one concern. First, we want to thank Senator Lori at a very late date to accommodate some of the things we were concerned about that have been taken care of by the oral amendment that was made during the meeting. One final point that I just want to leave with you is that by changing from a two-year time frame for if you have less than 2 years left on the term, that you can make an appointment to 1 year, you will require, therefore, cities to hold more frequent elections. And during the public hearing element that's now in the bill, that we have to hold the time frame for that 90-day period starts running with the public hearing. Well, we could have elections during various times of the year, and we may even have elections in some communities every year because we hold elections every other year, as the case is at the current time. But this could cause those elections to be held, and they will be held in many cases citywide. Of course, cities with wards have a lesser cost, but that's just one of the items that I wanted to bring to your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 3378? Senator Lori.
I have one more one-word author's amendment that wasn't caught in our author's amendment. On line 2.12, remove the word consulted and replace it with notified, given that we changed the consultation to a notification.
So where is that again?
Line 2.12, strike the word consulted and replace it with the word notified. Because we're notifying, not
on
consulting now.
On page 2, line 12, strike consulted, insert notified. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Anyone else wish to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 3378? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senate File, of the motion to recommend that Senate File 3378 as amended be recommended to pass, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold. Senator Betzold moves that Senate File 3120 be recommended to pass. Senator Betzold.
Hey, Madam Chair, there is an author's amendment.
There's an author's amendment.
I'll describe it while the author's amendment is being distributed. This deals with the open meeting law, and actually the author's amendment is going to strike sections 1 and 2 and make some minor changes to the remaining sections 3 and 4. So I'll only be really talking about sections 3 and 4 because the author's amendment is going to delete them. Section 3 is current law, which currently allows an open meeting to be closed under certain circumstances. This would require that the closed meeting be tape recorded and the tape be preserved for three years. The author's amendment is going to make an exception to that, and that is where attorney-client privilege is invoked. That is where the information that would not be disclosed under any circumstances, there's no reason to tape record that. Now, I also need to point out that just because the tapes are made and the tapes are preserved for 3 years
does not make them public. After 3 years, they can be destroyed. Why then tape record them? Sometimes there are lawsuits that will come up that may affect what happened during a closed session. And since the public meeting was closed, those tape recordings, you know, might be needed in the court process. However, as I say, there is nothing in here that would require, under any other circumstances, to make the data public that is recorded during the private meeting. The second section, in Section 4, deals with something that is in current law, that is commissioner opinions that are on data practices that are issued by the Department of Administration. The commissioner, you know, may, upon request, issue an opinion on data practices. This basically says that if somebody has asked for an opinion, and I guess if the government entity ignores that very opinion, then the person can go to court and be awarded attorney's fees if they ignore that. Now, I'll move the A1 amendment to actually put the bill in the shape that I just described and what I wish to proceed. So I'll move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Mr. McGowan.
Just to be clear, there was a typo in the amendment. The statutory site on 1.3 should be 13D05, not 305. And I attempted to correct that by hand, but just to make sure that it's clear that it's 13D05.
I'll incorporate that in the A1 amendment.
Senator Betzel, I felt very uncomfortable with just you and I voting on your bill, so we did ask members to come back briefly.
Especially if I had a tie vote.
I'm sure you didn't see. Yeah, right. You'd have gone really down.
Yeah.
And we are trying to be very fast about these, but it is, in my opinion, it is entirely inappropriate for one person to be chairing the committee and the other person to be voting on the bill. So I just could not do that. Sorry, members. We have the A1 amendment as modified before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment as modified is adopted. Senator Betzel.
We do have some folks who are here to give very brief testimony on the need for the bill, and there may be other people here with concerns, but I'll bring forward my witnesses up first.
Sir, if you just identify yourself, please, for the record, and we would appreciate it if your testimony would be brief. We do have one more bill that needs to be referred to another committee if it passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I will be very brief. This is a simple bill. We are urging its passage because it would remodel just some portions of what is a very important statute, a statute that does recognize an important part of democracy, and that is transparent and visible government. In the last few years, the effectiveness of the open meeting law has clearly declined, and this has not just been a problem for the news media, I assure you. If that's all it was a problem for, I probably wouldn't be here. But citizens have, in many instances in the last few years, recognized the problems that have accrued. And, in fact, in the last couple of years around the Capitol, legislators have approached us and pointed out problems their own constituents have had with the bill. They've asked us what can be done to improve it. Okay. This bill focuses on just a couple of the things that we might be able to improve in a short session. We did start out with a more ambitious bill. We've had extensive discussions with representatives of local governmental units, and the amendment adopted this afternoon reflects those discussions. The principal focus of this bill is to require tape recording of closed meetings. In our view, this will do several things. One, most importantly, it will deter improper closed meetings. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Secondly, it will create a record if there's a dispute about what occurred in a closed meeting. And thirdly, it will make the law more consistent. Currently, 3 of the 7 or 8 principal exceptions must be recorded now. The other 5 or so don't have to be. This will create a more consistent rule. So, Madam Chair, I will stop now, and if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them, of course.
Do you need to testify?
Madam Chair, I'm Lori Barakopensky. I direct the office that issues advisory opinions or assists the Commissioner of Administration in issuing advisory opinions. And the bill before you will strengthen the influence of an open meeting law opinion so that it is the same as one that data practices issued now, where they are given deference by the court as well as the ability to have attorney's fees. We have heard from our customers that frequently they can get an open meeting law advisory opinion, but it really doesn't have any weight. So this is a way that they can be given more weight and hopefully promote the kind of compliance with the open meeting law that you would like to see.
So you support the bill?
Yes.
Are there questions or comments for the witnesses or for Senator Betzel? Seeing none. Senator Betzel moves.
Is everybody else here? I don't.
Oh, is there anyone else that wishes to comment? Please be very brief.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans, and I represent Mr. the Deans. School Boards Association. Madam Chair, our problem with this bill deals with the taping provisions that are in Subdivision 3. Let me just give you just a real quick background. Right now, there's three kinds of meetings where we have to tape. If we're doing labor negotiation strategy sessions, or if they're purchasing land and they don't want the purchase price to be known to everyone, or if they're doing security briefings, those meetings have to be taped. Those are kind of general governmental things. The types of meetings that this is going to require to be taped are meetings where you're dealing with specific data about individuals and people. And the types of the statute allows us to close meetings to discuss data that would identify alleged victims or reporters of criminal sexual conduct, domestic abuse, or maltreatment of minors, to discuss educational data, that's data about your children or your students, health data, medical data, welfare data, mental health data, or to close meetings to discuss preliminary allegations against a public employee. If somebody is making an unsubstantiated claim against an employee, that's covered in a public meeting, because if that becomes public, that person's reputation is down the chute whether or not it was substantiated. So you've allowed those meetings to be closed. The problem is, if we have to tape these meetings, and those meetings, those tapes are held for 3 or 4 years, I can almost guarantee you that someplace in one school district or city or county or whatever, that tape is going to get mixed up with the other tapes of meetings, and that's going to get released, and somebody's going to be listening to that tape, and they're going to get this information that the legislature intended to be closed and not available to the public. We would try not to have that happen, but I can almost guarantee you in the nature of things it will. Because you got up here, you've got all the meetings, here's the tapes, all the meetings. That tape is going to get in that thing, and somebody's going to say, I want the tapes from February of 08, and they're just going to give them the tapes, and that one's going to be in there. We think that that's a bad result, as well as the additional requirement, the additional obligations that it's going to put on you to be taping these kinds of meetings. We're not 100% sure what all meetings are covered by this, because the statute allows meetings to be closed that are closed by other statutes too, and I'm not 100% sure which ones those are. We would suggest that that taping requirement does not add to the requirements of this bill. The language that you have on 3.23 to 3.27 about the opinion that deals with a specific political subdivision, and then they take action some other way and in violation of that, knowing what the opinion of IPAD is, that's a very narrow situation. This provision in sub 3 is a very broad one. We would ask that subdivision 3 be stricken from the bill.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to speak to one particular section, section 4. Line 21. There's one other policy change in this bill that we tried to work with Mr. Anfinson on, and we appreciate all the work he's done with us on the bill to this point. But we are striking the term attorney's fees from that particular line, which has the effect of allowing the awarding of attorney's fees not only for intentional violations of the open meeting law, but now for even unintentional violations of the open meeting law. And I would just suggest that you reinsert that stricken language on line 21.
Senator Betzel, do you have a response to the concerns?
Well, Madam Chair, as for the closing of the public meeting, once it's closed, of course, there's no record as to what was actually discussed there. And it may be very sensitive items, but I think, as I say, the only time it would come out would be, first of all, if some I imagine in many court situations they do it in camera. That is, the court would hear it first before it became public. So I think it is the kind of sensitive information that Ms. Beans discussed. It probably would not become public if it is that sensitive. On the other hand, if the open meeting was closed and in violation of open meeting law, then I think the tape recording would, or the recording might show that it should not have been closed. So that's just my thoughts. And on the attorney's fees, I'll just have to refer Mr. Anfinson.
Madam Chair, members, briefly, again, three of the exceptions to the open meeting law have required tape recording for years. I have never once heard of a single tape ever being disclosed. I mean, I respect Mr. Dean's concern, but the schools keep enormous amounts of highly sensitive data about students in other forms already. When do you hear of that being casually leaked out or disclosed? It shouldn't be that hard. And the public benefit that offsets that slight risk is very significant. On the attorney's fees issue, you have to remember, it's not going to, the courts still retain discretion, even if this slight change is made. The judge does not have to award fees. And believe me, this language only came into the law about 10 years ago. We are trying to restore what the law read in terms of attorney's fees before. Courts don't award serious attorney's fees penalties against public officials who accidentally or inadvertently violate the law. They retain discretion. Under the current language you see on attorney's fees, judges never award attorney's fees, and therefore citizens never can realistically challenge violations of the law. That's why the change is being made.
Is there discussion or questions for any of the witnesses?
I don't know if anybody else is here, Madam Chair.
Well, and I'm going to ask that, when they were there. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to the bill? If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Will Rosbach. I'm a city council person in the city of Maplewood, serving my second term, which I just mentioned because it's a correction to some information that you have, which lists me as a former council person.
Okay, sorry about that.
I also am in my 19th year of service to my city between elected positions and appointed
positions.
And
thank you
for that. I'm here to speak in favor of the recording portion of the bill before you. And you may find it interesting that the city of Maplewood would be advising you on what should be done with open meeting laws. This is an area where the city of Maplewood actually is ahead of the curve. We have been, for the last 2 years, recording all of our open meetings. And they serve, I think, a number of purposes. It may be a surprise to some that I don't believe that it's in a fractured council situation that you need to worry about a closed meeting violating the open meeting law. I think it is much more possible for it to happen if you have a cozy or a council that very well gets along with each other, and they may declare that they need to go into a closed meeting situation and then venture off into discussions about other things that are not appropriate for that closed session. I also would point out that we have had at least one time where we had to meet in a special closed meeting, but two of our members were missing. And so that allowed those two members to go back and listen to what was discussed at that meeting and be able to feel comfortable that the three of us that did meet were appropriate in our actions and also understand what it was that we talked about. And so although I would be in favor of much larger changes, this only seems to be what is being offered, and so I certainly support this effort.
Well, thank you very much for your firsthand experience. Are there questions or comments for this witness?
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Councilmember Rossbach, I know your city council has calmed down a bit in the last, I hope it's calmed down a little bit in the last few months. And I remember all the fights that were going on prior to the last election. I wonder, were any meetings then, you're saying, I was surprised, I thought you were going to say there had been a lot of closed meetings that shouldn't have been then, but you're saying because there was contention there, the closed meetings, they couldn't get away with stuff that they would have if everybody was on the same side.
That's correct. If you are in a very fractured situation, everyone is very keen on making sure the other person's not doing something wrong.
Are there further questions? Senator Larson. No.
To the bill, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I've got a very technical correction. On page 3, line 10, it says all meetings shall be tape recorded. I think that refers to an obsolete technology.
Mm-hmm.
If we just strike the word tape, because it could be digitally recorded or in some other format. So I'll move to strike the word tape.
Senator Betzel moves to strike the word tape.
If you're going to do that 3.11, you should probably refer to the recordings.
The recordings, yes. Thank you.
And strike tape whenever it precedes the word recording.
The second time it's just tapes.
Is there only two places?
Yes.
Second is tapes becomes recorded, records.
The recording shall be preserved.
Everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion of Senate file?
Whatever it is.
3120. Seeing none,
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I was compelled by the testimony on the attorney's fees issue, and I would move to reinstate the stricken language on 3.21. That still allows it says unless the court finds that there was specific intent, so it still gives the opportunity. Mm-hmm. To the court to do that. If
Senator Larson moves to reinsert the attorney's fees. Senator Betzel?
I'll oppose it, but you've heard the testimony, so.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion to amend by reinserting the attorney's fees, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Betzel renews his motion that Senate File 3120, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Correct.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Why would they oppose it? This
is going to go real fast.
Very good. What delivery? Go
soon. 2 in the next 10 minutes.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next two bills are going to involve people that have that are witnesses, and the first one I'd like to take up is Senate File 3202. I move that Senate File 3202 be recommended to pass. 3202 is a kind of a cleanup bill. We call it a cleanup bill?
Yep.
There's
the amendment.
The Department of Employee Relations to implement the policy that is an agency bill, to implement the policy that was adopted in 2007. To abolish the Department of Employee Relations. There is an amendment, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is an amendment. It is the AO8 1134.
Senator Rest moves the AO8
1134, and it is.
Mr. Chairman?
Is it in here?
Mr. Bodern.
I'm not familiar with that amendment. I think there may be an amendment for another bill.
The amendment reads on page 5 after line 2, insert, and this is section 8 of the bill, and it amends 43804, subdivision 2. And what it's doing is to make sure that the commissioner may appoint one deputy with principal responsibility for employee relations, and that the deputy shall serve in the unclassified service. Are you telling me you don't have that amendment?
Bodden.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a copy of that amendment. I don't think there's one in the pack, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yes. We'll come back to that. Copies are being made. We only need four.
Is that the only amendment, Senator Rest, to the
That's
bill?
Right. Mm-hmm. And that amendment is to allow a deputy to be appointed by the Commissioner of Finance within the Finance Department to have a deputy with principal responsibility for employee relations.
We can vote on that when we have the copies. Take testimony,
just
please.
To let you know that's what it is. And Commissioner Anderson is here and can explain why we needed this cleanup bill.
Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment is simply a drafting error. This is something that we discussed with MAPE when we talked about the bill a year ago, and they would like to retain the deputy position for the chief negotiator, essentially, so that they have that authority. That's all that is. This bill just simply cleans up what we need to do to have the department merged by June 1. It's required by the legislation that was passed last year, it's uncontroversial. There's nothing in here that wasn't essentially required last year.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that people do now have that that amendment. The revisor's copy of it is AO 81275, and I will give this to the committee clerk in addition to the language that he had from there. And the amendment came from the revisor. So, Mr. Chairman, I move the AO 81275 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the AO 81275 amendment. Are there questions for Senator Rest? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator
Mr.
Rest?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 3202 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 3202 be recommended to pass. Are there any questions?
Amended.
As amended. As amended. Are there any questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 3202? Seeing none, Senator Rest renews her motion that Senate File 3202 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would like to take up now Senate File 3203.
Senate File 3203 is before us. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, 3203 makes an adjustment. It's very interesting. Somehow, a copy of Senate File 3203 from the 2006 legislative session got put in this bill file, and it has to do with the length of the school year. And that's not what this is, of course. This is a bill that's relating to horse racing and modifying certain medication requirements. And it's really a very technical amendment that recognizes that the technology of detecting medications in horses has, in the horse racing industry, has grown by leaps and bounds, and it's an attempt to bring common sense to the detection of these medications. And we're going to have some very brief testimony about why this is necessary. This also is an agency bill, and it is not controversial. Mr. Kruger?
In one moment, Mr. Kruger, Mr. McGowan.
Mr. Chairman, I have one technical archaic language cleanup amendment. Page 1, line 13, delete the and insert there and delete thereof. So it would read, provided their use does not exceed. We don't say thereof
anymore. Mr. Chairman,
anymore.
That would be my amendment.
Senator Rest moves that amendment. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Mr. Krueger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dick Krueger, the Executive Director of the Racing Commission. What this bill does is the Racing Commission is asking the legislature for authority to set by rule regulatory threshold concentrations of medications and their metabolites. Our current testing can confirm in blood and urine almost any therapeutic and legal medication at any amount, that's even a trace amount, that would have no pharmacological effect on the racehorse at race time. And this would result in a positive test for horsemen and women and then a subsequent penalty under rule and law. The threshold level is a level of medication of environmental contaminant in the blood or urine that have been shown to have no pharmacological effect on the performance of the horse. And the thresholds will be identified by the commission based upon sound scientific research and industry standards that indicate no pharmacological effect on the performance of the horse. So that in a broad brush is the intent of the bill. Dr. Hovde is here, our chief veterinarian. She can go into a little more of the background of this issue or answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Krueger. Doctor, could you state your name for the record and spell that if you need to?
My name is Dr. Lynn Hovda, and I'm the Chief Commission Veterinarian for the Minnesota Racing Commission. And I think in a nutshell, I can tell you that in the 15 years I've been doing this, we've gone from measuring medications in parts per million to parts per billion, now to parts per trillion. And we're now picking up things in the urine and the blood that were administered to the horses in good faith. At the appropriate time, the appropriate dose, and we're getting some very minuscule parts per trillion samples or positive samples of things that were given perhaps 19 days ago, 21 days ago, or as minuscule as your own granddaughter coming through the barn and giving a chocolate chip cookie 5 days before the horse raced and picking up the active ingredient in that, which is theobromine in a very small, maybe even a taste of a chocolate chip cookie. No effect on racing performance, as you can all see and understand, but the testing has just gotten so good, and zero has become such a tiny, 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 tiny number now that we need to give the horsemen who are doing everything in good faith, we need to help them, and the ones that are actually trying to beat the system need to be penalized.
Thank you, Dr. Hubba. Are there any questions for the witnesses or Senator Rest? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would move then that Senate File 3203, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 3203, as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank the bill you, is Mr. passed. Chairman. I now would like to take up Senate File 2804.
Senate File 2804 is before us. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2804 deals with requiring schools to use environmentally sensitive cleaning and maintaining products and established guidelines in a task force. And the bill came to this committee after we modified it in on education to be much more permissive and practical for the school districts, and at that point was not then opposed as some sort of unfunded mandate. But I do believe Mr. Bodden discovered that we needed an additional amendment in with regard to the task force, which is going to advise the commissioner on education with regard to these. And I believe that's the A3 amendment. Is that correct?
Senator Rest moves the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A3 amendment And it just requires the appointing authority for the people who are going to advise the commissioner to complete those appointments by September 1st, and it designates the commissioner of education or her designee to serve as chair of this task force and to convene the first meeting, et cetera, and to bring it into compliance with our guidelines. And the on line 110, the expiration date, Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, the bill does not provide one right now. It does require annual support from the task force, and it looks like these are annual reports that continue indefinitely. If you don't do anything under 15059, it would expire June 30th of next year, I believe. It's an open question whether you want to make it permanent. It does have continuing duties.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to make it permanent. I do want it to go on for a couple of years, though, as this program would get started, and then we could review whether it needed to be continued. So what if we said June 30th of 2011.
Senator Resting would incorporate that
mm-hmm.
into the A3 amendment. Is there further discussion? All those in favor of the A3 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A3 amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any additional testifiers. I don't know if there's anybody in the room that wants to.
Senator Roebling.
By now.
Thank you. Madam Chair. On page 2, line 7, it says that we want two members from the environmentally sensitive cleaning and maintenance product industry to be appointed. And I guess I have a little bit of concern about that. I can understand somebody being there, maybe one person, to provide information about products.
Mm-hmm.
But quite frankly, this could be a bit of a conflict of interest, because if they don't carry certain products in their product base, they may try to eliminate them from the list of usable products. And I would think one would be sufficient on their
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I would accept that as an amendment.
Okay, Madam Chair, then I move on page 2, line 7, that we change the number 2 from 1. To one.
Senator Roebling moves on line 2.7 that 2 be stricken and 1 be inserted.
No, it's on line 2.5 or
2.7.
Okay.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bodern.
Just to be clear, we'll pick this up anyway, but you'd need to delete 2 members and insert 1 member.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Bodern. That being incorporated, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, then if there's no further testimony, I would move that Senate File 2804 be, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 2804? Seeing none, Senator Rest moves that Senate File 2804, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go to Senate File 2914.
Senate File 2914 is before us.
Chairman, this is a bill that was heard in the Judiciary Committee and comes because there is a task force that there is a group that is to be appointed by the Secretary of State to study ways in which to come up with efficient and cost-effective ways to implement, and I'm looking at the second page, an electronic system for submission, et cetera, of statewide foreclosure data. And there's a working group in subdivision 2 that is states who should be in it. And in consultation with Mr. Bodern, we didn't need to say who should appoint these people because the groups are named, the common sense assumption can be made that they will send their own member. We did note that, in general, our guidelines include when somebody makes a report that proposed legislation be included. And so I would move on line 2.27 to insert after recommendations, including draft legislation.
Senator Rest moves on line 2.27 after recommendations, including draft legislation. Are there any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, that's why the bill came here. The issues of bringing together foreclosure data to make it available in a more streamlined way to allow those who are helping people deal with foreclosure issues be able to do that, and then to study whether or not it's feasible and helpful and a benefit to have the data collected electronically.
Very good. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Senate File 2914. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary of State's office requests that the Section 3 be in the effective dates, line 2.34, that the Section 3 be effective the day following an enactment so that the working group could begin work right away, and I would move that.
Mr. Bodern, can you give
Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 34, after the period, insert Section 3 is effective the day following final enactment.
Does everyone have that? All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, if there is no further testimony from the public.
Is there anyone in the public that would like to testify on Senate File 2914? Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 2914 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 2914 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Then, Mr. Chairman, the final bill I have is Senate File 3180. Is that correct?
Yes. Senate File 3180
is
before us.
That's what I have on my list here. Somehow I have another bill in my folder, but I don't think we're taking that one up. And there is an author's amendment.
It's
coming. Essentially,
it isn't passed out yet, but we're working on that. I think
what the bill does is address an issue with regard to when there is a dispute or misunderstanding about the fiscal notes that are provided by state agencies or the Department of Revenue, to allow legislators in a kind of an official way of questioning the analyses and the rationale for those notes and the either fiscal notes or revenue estimates. And the upon further review, we had originally had the bill was drafted for the Legislative Coordinating Commission, but the author's amendment retains the language but directs the review to be conducted by the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy. The Legislative Coordinating Commission, as I understand it, does not have minority representation to any extent, and the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy does. And there is, we would expect that the process would be used very, very infrequently. But when there is a legitimate dispute, which would be decided by the legislative commission, that there would be an opportunity for author of a bill to do that. We would allow those appeals not to be, I mean, the author of a bill could bring it to the chairs, but the appeal would have to be initiated by either the chair of the House or the Senate Tax Committee or Ways and Means or the Finance chair of the Finance Committee, and then identify what it is in the fiscal note or revenue estimate that's being contested. One of the things from time to time that's been suggested has been that the legislature, like Congress, should set up its own legislative budget office. There are those of us that, although we would like more attention paid to fiscal notes by the legislature, think that that would be a mistake. It would be costly and probably not serve us very well in our budget process. But this would be an opportunity, again, on a fairly rare occurrence, for the legislature to enter into discussion with the Department of Finance and the Department of Revenue on a formal basis to discuss fiscal notes and revenue estimates. Mr. Chairman, this bill would go to taxes, and I know earlier Mr. Manson was here from the Department of Revenue, and with the bill in taxes, I'm expecting that he and the someone from the Department of Finance would come, and there would be a far more full discussion of this process in that committee.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, I think you mentioned that you could appeal through the chair of the tax committee or the finance committee, but it's not listed in here. I'm only seeing that only the tax chairs could put in the appeal.
Senator Roebling, actually, I think the finance is in subdivision 5 appeal.
In my delete all, if you look, it's to initiate appeal the chair of the House Representatives Committee on Ways and Means or the chair of the Senate Committee on Finance for fiscal notes, and then in subdivision 5 for revenue estimates, and now you go down to line 130, the chair of the Committee on Taxes of the House of Representatives or the chair of the Tax Committee of the Senate on revenue estimates. So the respective appropriate committees.
Thank you. I found it now up in subdivision 5 up on top. Under section 2 subdivision.
Mr. Chairman,
5.
I do want to point out that this would be something that is a departure. I do think it is a transparency in government move, but I do expect that there would be a full discussion of it in the tax committee and later in the finance committee, but the tax committee asked to have it first.
Well, I think the way this is set up, it's something would be rare, but something that on every so often there's an occasion where this, I think, is necessary. Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. Is there any further discussion regarding the A1 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there any further discussion to the bill or anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 3180 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 3180 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 3180 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
There being no further business before the committee, this committee is adjourned.
Thank you.